Good afternoon. I'm calling the meeting of the Senate Committee on General Government to order. And we're going to open a work session on Senate Bill 276. Dan Kennedy, do you want to join us just for now here? We have a two amendments.
Well, Mr. Chairman, thank you. Members of the committee, I'm Dan Kennedy. I'm the administrator of the Human Resource Services Division of the Department of Administrative Services. Mr. Chairman, we've talked about this bill several times before in a couple of iterations, and I'd just like to say that the Dash 2 amendments meet our needs, and we're happy to support them.
Okay. Any questions from the members of the committee?
Chair, I move the Dash 2 amendments to Senate Bill 276.
Dash 2 amendments have been moved by Senator Crowell. Any discussion? Dash 2 amendments are adopted.
Chair, I move amended 276 before the Senate for the pass recommendation.
Okay, Senate Bill 276 has amended been moved to the floor with a pass recommendation by Senator Crowell. Any discussion?
I don't think I can support the
All right. What's the call at all?
Senator Lynn.
No.
Senator Steele.
Aye.
Senator Trout.
Aye.
Aye. Bill 276 will be sent to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Close the work session on Senate Bill 276. Carrier.
Okay.
Senate Control will carry the bill. Alright.
Now expect support from those who voted.
Yes. Without leaving in the works. Okay. I'm ready to open the
door if you want to pass.
That's right. Sure, your leg worked well. I'm ready to open the work session on Senate Bill 879. Okay, Bob Shelby. You can go over, bro. Good to see you again. I think we did a dash one amendment to this.
Chair Dungeon, members of the committee, Senate Bill 879 was brought forward on the 15th of April, at which time we did have testimony from Bob Shelby related to this bill. There was some concern whether local governments would be accepting of the Dash 1 amendment. We have heard from Senator Byer's office that they did contact local governments, cities and counties, and there is no opposition to the amendment at this time.
Okay, do we have any from cities and counties here? They have not signed up for it.
No.
Okay. Any questions from us?
Sure, I move the dash one. I'm the one that held it up wanting questions, and I think I'm satisfied with it.
Okay. Senator Control moves the dash one amendments. Is there any discussion on the dash one amendments? Hearing none, but adopted.
Sure, I move Senate Bill 879 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senate Bill moves 879 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Reed.
Aye.
Senator
Hill.
Aye.
Senator
Trump.
Aye. Aye. Bill 879 is amended. Super votes will go from four with a due pass record.
I wish you got the Senator Byer.
Yes, Senator Byer will be the carrier of that bill, and it's adopted. We'll close the work session on Senate Bill 879. Thank you for making the trip up. It was nice and easy, wasn't it? Okay. I'm going to open a public hearing on I didn't close the work session on 879, so it's not closed. Opening a public hearing on Senate Bill 898. Mary? You have seven people with you, is that it?
We're going to be very brief.
Okay.
very appreciated. The stage of the game.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Mary Botson. I'm here representing the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. With us today in the hearing room are a group of folks from juvenile detention facilities. Today they're here from Multnomah County, but we represent about 1,000 folks statewide who work in maximum and medium security facilities in the counties and local government. Just by way of introduction of who these folks are, these professional juvenile detention workers and probation officers represent the last best hope that at-risk have. They work daily with the most violent, the sickest, and the most in need youth in our state. They risk their lives and their personal safety every day. As many of you know, we also represent adult corrections, probation, and parole folks. And I have to tell you, just as an aside, our folks in adult corrections think that these people are crazy for doing the work that they do, because unfortunately, kids tend to be more violent and less careful about the battles that they pick. And as we know, over the last few years, unfortunately, our youth become even more violent than they have been in the past. This bill, if passed, Senate Bill 898, would place these folks in PERS, police, and fire retirement. Now, I have to tell you that some of those folks that we represent, some of the thousands, already get police and fire retirement for PERS. It is a hit-and-miss system at best. At worst, it is a system which represents who's had whatever ability to force the system to accept them by virtue of job titles or political muscle. And this bill would simply balance out the system. It would stop kind of the hit and miss method by which we've placed folks in there and say that we're going to acknowledge the fact that juvenile corrections is as dangerous as adult corrections. And it really doesn't matter whether you work in Deschutes County or Wallowa County or Multnomah County or Lane County, whether you're called a juvenile life counselor or a juvenile parole officer or a juvenile probation officer, that you do indeed do a job that makes it nearly impossible for you to do a full career in the public service. So with that, you know, I know what they do. I know the environments they work in, but you know, I can't tell you what it's like to be one of them any better than they can. And with that, Mr. Chair, I'd like to just step away and allow them to tell you their story, and then I'll be available for questions.
Okay. Thank you, Mary.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You've done a very nice job of setting the stage.
Thank you. There's an awareness
of that. Now, I guess the thing that's probably bothering me, and I don't know if I speak to my colleagues up here, as we've listened during this session thus far in this committee, there are many inequities out there, and it seems to me that at some point we really need to take a look at the inequities. We've had other groups before us, and I sit here and I say, my gosh, they really do live under some very extreme circumstances. And I'm not, I don't want to say in a bad state, so I'm not sure things are going to get resolved in this session. But it would be my hope, Mr. Vice Chair, and members of the committee, someplace along the line, that an interim or something, that someone takes on the task of really looking at the inequities that do exist out there. And because they're there, the needs are there, I have to admit, with PERS and everything, the timing is not exactly the most beautiful timing. But that's why we held the public hearing there. I think we want to get it on the record. And for those of you who are not sure that this process, it takes it takes time. Things don't happen all of a sudden in one session. And I think it's important to get things on the record and to get it moving. And so that's why I wanted to be sure to have a public hearing for you folks today. So I don't want you to expect great things out of this particular budget. You just left of this committee, some great things could happen, but we have a whole group to work with. And but at least we're getting it on the record, and I hope down the road that somebody can straighten out some of these inequities that do exist.
Mr. Chair, yeah. I want to thank you for that statement, and I think that both, I know that OPEU has members in the hearing room as well that will be testifying briefly, and I think that we both tried to make it abundantly clear to our members that they should not come here with false hope, and that they should not see this as the end of a process at the beginning. And that we want, you know, with term limits, Mr. Chair, we have to keep re-educating.
You gotta keep going.
So,
all right, well, I'll be has-beens before long.
Anyway, I'll...
Okay, well, thank you very much. Would you please identify yourself?
Thank you very much. My name's Brian Montgomery. I work for Multnomah County Department of Juvenile and Adult Community Justice.
Georgia Juvenile Department.
Georgia Juvenile Committee. Thank you. I give you the long version of our department's title because I think it's important to note that half of our department already qualifies for these benefits, and our house does not. And we do essentially the same type of work with different age groups. I'll give you a quick overview of our department and leave some of the specifics up to some of my colleagues. The document you're receiving right now is a flowchart that I came up with that shows sort of the symbiotic relationship between our department and other departments.
Excuse me, would you once again give the exact title of your department?
I apologize. I didn't put on it. Multnomah County Department of Juvenile and Adult Community Justice. Juvenile and Adult Community Justice.
Adult. Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. When a person is detained by a police officer, they're sent one of two places, generally, adult or juvenile. If they're brought to the juvenile department, we essentially have two factions within our department, within the juvenile department, secure and non-secure, or custody and counseling, if you will. And in working with those, the youth will be detained for a certain amount of time, go to court, be placed on probation. Eventually, there may be a decision made to what's called temporarily commit that youth to the Oregon Youth Authority. Now, just by virtue of the statute under which OYA falls within the FERS, police, and fire, they are eligible for that because they supervise OYA youth. So do Multnomah County probation officers and custody services specialists by statute. We are housing and supervising OYA youth in conjunction with OYA workers. We're doing the same job, essentially. Now, we call upon the OYA to do certain specific things. For instance, when a youth needs to be placed out of a home, sent to a foster home or a group home, the county cannot do that. It has to be done by the state, and we essentially ask a judge to order that. That's how that process goes. But we still cover the case. We're still supervising that youth along with an OYA worker. If they come back as a parolee, they're housed in our facility. Any new adjudications, if a youth were to commit a crime while at McLaren Hillcrest, we would adjudicate that youth as a Multnomah County kid. I'd also like to speak a little bit about how we collaborate with the police departments throughout the community. Specifically, if I may address Senator Lynn and Senator Shields, there's a couple of different things going on in your community, the community in which you represent, respectively. Senator Lynn, there's a team that I belong to called the East County High-Risk Youth Team, and we meet once a month. I had to miss a meeting today, unfortunately. It's Gresham Police Officers, Troutdale, Multnomah County Sheriffs, probation officers from our department and from the adult side, and it's essentially a roundtable meeting. We take a couple of hours, and we lay it out online what's going on in the community. We talk about, it's no holds barred, we talk about what youth are doing in the community and how are we going to address it. It's an excellent team building exercise that we go through once a month, and it's an excellent way to exchange information. And if I may be so bold, I would invite you to come out and visit. We have barbecue once a year in the summer. It'd be a great time for you to come see it. Senator Shields, there's another team that I'm a part of called YGAP, Youth Gun Anti-Violence. It's a multi-jurisdictional team. Police departments from literally all over the state, all over the region, along with parole probation officers. We meet every 2 weeks at Northeast Precinct, and we're discussing things that are going on in the community with youth and adults, because we have adult probation officers there. And oftentimes those are overlapping. As you can imagine, I myself may go to make a home visit to check on a youth who's on probation to find out he has older siblings or even parents who are under supervision within our department on the adult side. The reason I say all this is just to give you a description of what we are doing, how it sort of melds along with the adult system, and how we work with the police department. We do different jobs, we have different duties and tasks, but we are working together. And again, I would just say, come see us, come visit us, drop by. We're at the King facility, just off of MLA. Stop in anytime. Doors always open here at Falcon. I thank you very much for your time.
If Senator Lim comes to visit, can he stay?
As long as he wants, absolutely.
Thank you very much. Why don't we just keep filling in here? And I'm going to have to be rather brief because I do have quite a list of people to testify. And we also have a lot of bills. And today, as you realize, is the last day I can be hearing Senate bills. So I have to kind of keep people moving. So if I move you a bit fast, you'll understand why we're doing so today. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair, members of the committee, for hearing me. I'll try to talk fast. Most of you get up
you're
in the morning.
Our attention, I can assure you that.
And most of you get up in the morning, go in your office, have a cup of coffee, check your schedule, see what the day is up. If you're a custody service worker, by the way, my name is Bruce Kishar, custody service worker in Multnomah County. If you do my job, gentlemen, the first thing you do in the morning is count. You count pencils, you count pens, you count rulers, you count combs, you count picks, you count toothbrushes. We count everything that can be used as or can be fashioned into a weapon. Okay? We're not real compulsive people. We don't count because we like to. We count because we have a dangerous population. I have here the risk assessment instrument for Multnomah County. It's a risk assessment instrument where you found point values of certain crimes. Read through this, imagine a youth, imagine a crime, imagine a family life, do a score, and see what it takes to hold a juvenile in detention. The juveniles held in detention are felons.
I'm sure this is even more so in your mind these last few weeks with all of the attention.
Yeah. I have something here I can show you. Okay, it's a list of names. It's a list of names dating back from 1989 to 1999. 65 years. All Multnomah County residents, all stayed at Multnomah County Juvenile Detention, all charged with murder. I can't show you a confidential one. I guess you guys have to do that too. There's a lot about our job is dangerous. And we have... These are all taken as admissions when the youth come to the facility. It's going to work now.
We'll get this put it back together.
Yeah. Got to get the chips on that.
Yeah.
Okay. These are all confiscated at admission. The kids carry on. You know, the environment where these kids come from, life is cheap. Okay. And despite everything I told you, I just want to impress upon you that the one thing that makes our job dangerous, probably the single most thing that makes our job dangerous, is that when we're in a detention facility, we work with the kids. They are not locked up in rooms. We don't just walk by the windows and count bodies. We don't file them out to let them walk around in the exercise yard. We recreate with them. We eat with them. We talk to them. Okay? We believe that we are the last best hope these kids have, which is probably why the adult system thinks we're nuts. Okay? But there are a few successes out there.
That makes it rewarding and worthwhile, probably, to you.
Anything
That's
something about that. I think I'll just pass it on. You guys want
okay. To... Well, thank you very much. Appreciate your... Yeah. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Mr. Chair, my name is Will Wilhite. I am a probation officer for Multnomah County as well with Brian. For the past 8 years, I've been in the gang unit. I'm now at the north unit. What I'm going to do is read some scenarios in the day of the life of a probation officer from Multnomah County. These were actual incidents that caused us to feel that we are in jeopardy with life and limb. There were shots fired at the North District office during the work hours. A neighbor threatens to kill a youth that has an appointment with a probation officer. Shots were fired at a PO's car, probation officer's car, while transporting another youth. PO was cornered in her office by a father and threatened her. A kid threatened another probation officer, and for several months she had to check in with the action team to check her car for tripwires because he threatened to vomit. Routinely, probation officers in homes where weapons are present unarmed ourselves. From the sex offender unit, youth frequently fantasize violence about their therapists and probation officers, talking about rape and dismemberment. Therapists from the department are frequently in homes where there's domestic violence, drug manufacturing, and history of criminal activity. Recently, a probation officer from my unit was threatened in his entire family for committing a youth to the state training school. It has all filled the team and the gang units to be involved as a part of our job definition with funerals and a ready response team with the police to defuse rival gangs as they have a lot of emotional retaliation from shootings and deaths. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Hello, my name is Elisa Stubblefield. I work for Juvenile Custody Services in the secured area of detention at Multnomah County. I'm going to speak to you about some instances that we've had in our facility over the last couple of years. Our most notorious one was on July 15, 1998, when the OIA facility, who ripped two inmates out of our building, had a riot. The CAF staff for OIA and the county, our county staff had to come in and help secure down. We were the first ones to respond. We're the ones that secured down their kids. And again, just recently on April 10th, we had a similar situation in one of our secured outside recreational zones. And four youth were trying to escape, attack staff, and actually assaulted staff. And once again, we had to come in and secure their children. Over the last also several years, we've had our own different instances that occurred, primarily an escape attempt that happened about a year ago, where two youths in the shower at night snuck out. Once they waited until this graveyard staff came on and was trying to attack that staff. Luckily, he saw him and was able to secure himself. In debriefing those youths later, they said they would have harmed or killed the staff. These are the youths that we were working with.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, I am Jody Gar. I am the program lead in the Department of Juvenile and Adult Community Justice with Multnomah County. I lead the programs that are the accountability programs, the restitution programs, community service programs, and we have a forest project program where we take youth out of custody or out of the probation community and take them up in the forest and where they learn skills and skill building to become contributing members of the community. Also, I'm responsible for seeing that $100,000 in restitution is paid to victims of Multnomah County. I want to touch upon a couple things. Multnomah County, as you know, is a large complex. Please be aware that we do have one of our units, it's for sex offenders only, in Multnomah County, and that's statewide. We have parole youth there, and we have custody services staff with Multnomah County that supervise those youth.
Okay, this is strictly young people.
Right,
okay.
It's true. It is up to 6 months. Another unit that we have in custody is what we call our AITP program, which is a 30-day treatment program for probation violators. The Forest Project is a program designed for probation violators. I also want to point out in our counseling side of our department, we have an array of different units that fill the needs of whatever the community has. We have a new truancy program, so Multnomah County is in the business for working with six-year-old children who are not attending school, where we have truant officers going to the homes without knowing anything about the families. Most of those youth families are known to the court through dependency or through delinquency from older siblings. I also want to add that that's our prevention of keeping youth in school and our advocacy for that from our department. We also have what we call a diversion program, and after being the lead in program units, sometimes our diversion youth and our first-time offenders are pretty scary because they're not known, their families are not known to the court. We have no upfront assessment, and those employees go to homes without knowing anything. And we have often found ourselves constantly calling 911 for police backup. I don't think I have to tell you about the population. I've been in the building for 22 years. I don't have to tell you the growing violence in our country and the family issues, the drug issues, and I think you all know that. I think anybody that turns on a television any time during the day sees what is happening in our community, our state, and our country. I'm very proud to be a member of the state, and I'm very proud to be a member and an employee of Multnomah County. We are trying to do things. Our employees need the support of our state government to put us in and treat us like our job description is. I read this bill. We are doing exactly what police and fire people that are getting it. Thank you very much.
Hey, thank you very much. Yes.
Hi, my name is Deborah Meade. I'm a
Oh, you certainly live in a very nice neighborhood.
I brought a police report with me that, of course, I can share with you because it has some new information, but on Sunshine, when you and I were probably home with our family in the evening, these four particularly are going home that belong to one of the families and went to Portsmouth School. And you know where that is?
Yeah, you
really okay. Yes, yeah. Okay. I've been trying to stand. Church and
in court. Yeah. Pull up close to you.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. I think I've done this everything. Took a rifle and went to Portsmouth School and shot in through the window of two of the young men's home room. And this was after their teacher had received threats from them ongoing. And then they broke into the school later. They came back, broke into the school later on that night through a basement window, went into the room, let the fired at the aquarium, the fish aquarium first, and obliterated it, and then let the mother rabbit, who had six babies, out of her cage and shot her to death and took four of the babies with them, who of course died, and then let the white rat out of its cage and attempted to shoot it to death as well. These are, I only bring this to you because it's the latest of what we have to deal with. We are adjudicating these young men right now. We got this Monday morning.
Now, are you personally, are those
yes.
ones you have to deal with
yes.
yourself?
Yes. This is my unit. I'm in this adjudication unit, and we adjudicate these children and work with the families. The families do not really see anything wrong with what their children do, and that's very unfortunate. These are the kind of young people we deal with. I haven't been at Multnomah County but 4 years. I grew up in a family that was involved. My father was a police officer. My brothers are police officers. I'm aware of the culture. Guns with these youth have become so common that when we get police reports on the mornings that we're at work, if they involve a gun. It doesn't even surprise us. In fact, if they don't, that's what surprises us. And these are the kind of young people we deal with.
Well, thank you very much for today. Sorry, we're frustrating everybody all along, but I'm sure, knowing those of us on the committee, we have lots of questions we'd like to talk to you more, but I think we've got to keep it moving.
We'll be as quickly as we can.
Okay.
I'm John Hawkins, Sheriff Duncan. I'm from the Lynn County Juvenile Department. I have the pleasure of living in Senator Crow's district.
It's a fairly nice neighborhood, too, isn't it?
The whole city. And we have representatives, staff folks from Jackson County, Lynn County, and Marion counties who are going to describe to you some of the incidents they've had to experience. And if we have time, we have one of our folks from Lynn County Detention who will be also demonstrating one of her experiences in detention. I'll just briefly say I've been a detention worker for 15 years. Prior to that, I worked for Children's Services Division for 13 Protective Services. We are dealing with a very changed population from what I started out with nearly 30 years ago. And I will turn them over to John Hawkins, not Hawkins, to...
threats from them ongoing. And then they broke into the school later. They came back, broke into the school later on that night through a basement window, went into the room, fired at the aquarium, the fish aquarium first, and obliterated it, and then let the mother rabbit, who had six babies, out of her cage and shot her to death. And took four of the babies with them, who of course died, and then let the white rat out of its cage and attempted to shoot it to death as well. I only bring this to you because it's the latest of what we have to deal with. We are adjudicating these young men right now. We got this Monday morning.
Now, are you personally, are those
yes.
ones you have to deal with
yes.
yourself?
Yes. This is my unit. I'm in the adjudication unit, and we adjudicate these children and work with the families. The families do not really see anything wrong with what their children did, and that's very unfortunate. These are the kind of young people we deal with. I haven't been at Multnomah County but 4 years. I grew up in a family that was involved. My father was a police officer. My brothers are police officers. I'm aware of the culture. Guns with these youth have become so common that when we get police reports on the mornings that we're at work, if they involve a gun, it doesn't even surprise us. In fact, if they don't, that's what surprises us. And these are the kind of young people we deal with.
Thank you very much for today. Sorry, we're hustling everybody all along, but I'm sure. Knowing those of us on the committee, we have lots of questions we'd like to talk to you more, but I think we've got to keep it moving.
We'll be as quickly as we can.
Okay.
I'm John Hawkins, Sheriff Duncan. I'm from the Lynn County Juvenile Department. I have the pleasure of living in Senator Crow's district.
It's a fairly nice neighborhood, too, isn't it?
The whole city. And we have representatives, staff folks from Jackson County, Lynn County, and Marion counties who are going to describe to you some of the incidents they've had to experience. And if we have time, we have one of our folks from Lynn County Detention who will be also demonstrating one of her experiences in detention. I'll just briefly say I've been a detention worker for 15 years. Prior to that, I worked for Children's Services Division for 13 Protective Services. We are dealing with a very changed population from what I started out with nearly 30 years ago. And I will turn them over to John Hawkins, not Hawkins, to share some words.
Yes, Hawkins.
Good afternoon, Chairman Duncan and members of the committee. For the record, my name is John Hawkins. I'm a juvenile probation officer in Jackson County, and I am a field probation officer. I work on the streets and homes and schools for these kids. And I'm also part of the only class of law enforcement that is not covered by police and fire, it occurs. I've worked in corrections for almost 20 years, and most of my experience has been as an adult probation officer. A little over 4 years ago, I grew weary of dealing with the same hardcore criminals repeatedly, and I transferred to the juvenile department. At that time, I didn't believe...
You had to work with the kiddies, huh?
That's right. At that time, I didn't believe that adolescent criminal behavior was any different between adults and juveniles. I got to tell you, I was wrong. Although the work is essentially the same, volatile adolescent emotions combined with poor impulse control make juveniles much more likely to resist physical than being taken into custody. During all the years I worked as an adult probation officer, I probably arrested several hundred probation violators, and I was never assaulted by an offender and seldom even threatened. Now I frequently have to restrain combative youngsters in less than friendly environments in their homes and their schools and their communities, or even shopping malls. I've had to chase kids through blackberry patches and across parking lots. And I've conducted the same type of searches on the kids that I used to conduct on adults, and I found the same things, knives, guns, and drugs. I'm often dealing with the kids of offenders I supervise as an adult probation officer. I've probably got 5 or 6 on my caseload right now that I also supervise as an adult. One of them I even sent to prison. I've been threatened more times than I can count, but I was mostly in the last 4 years. Now, I don't want you to think I'm complaining. I love this work. But I do believe that those of us who are employed by county juvenile departments are as deserving of police and fire first benefits as co-workers in our counties who supervise adult offenders and of our Oregon Youth Authority counterparts who receive the juvenile offenders from us. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Good afternoon, Chairman Duncan and committee members. My name is John Schaefer, and I'm a probation officer with Marion County. I have worked at the juvenile department for 16 years. As you've heard, our job can be dangerous. In 1988, I was taking a youth into custody who was in our court school program because he had violated his court order. He resisted, and during a struggle, I fell and broke my kneecap. I missed 5 weeks of work, and I still have a wire around my kneecap. Once a month, I work in the courtroom providing courtroom security. I handcuff any juvenile that the judge decides must go to detention for new crimes they've committed or for violating the conditions of probation. Several times, I've had to struggle with and restrain clients who are uncooperative or tried to run from the courtroom. It's not just juveniles who pose a threat to juvenile probation officers. I often think the parents may present more of a danger than the children. Yesterday was pretty typical for me. I met with two families during the afternoon. During the first meeting, the father was unhappy with me because his 11-year-old son won't mind him and leaves the home without his permission. Now, the father's understandably frustrated with his son's behavior, but he wanted to leave his son at the juvenile department and permanently terminate his parental responsibilities. He is upset with me when I explained that was not possible. I told him I would work with him and provide consequences for his son's behavior, but the juvenile department and the court were not going to relieve him of his parental responsibility. I also advised him to talk with his son's psychologist about these issues. The next family I met with regarding an assault at one of the middle schools, the mother was upset with me because her son had been charged with assault, and I was going to hold him accountable and impose some consequences for his crime. I was not threatened yesterday in either of these situations, but there was certainly tension and conflict. I have been threatened in the past, more often by parents than kids. One of my fellow probation officers in Marion County will be riding along tonight with Salem Police Department. She has a caseload of gang members and will be visiting the homes of her clients to check on them this evening with a Salem police officer. This is something that gang probation officers in our county do on a weekly basis. During those ride-alongs, she wears a bulletproof vest. There are 3 of our probation officers who are currently doing this in an effort by the department to reduce gang violence and gang membership. I don't think I need to go into details about the dangers they face when monitoring gang members on their home turf at night. Now, our job can be fulfilling. It's a job where I deal with conflict every day. There's stress in the job, and there's real potential for danger. When you work with at-risk kids and families in the role of a juvenile probation officer, the juvenile is not the only one at risk. I hope you will support this bill. Thank you for your
time.
Thank
you very much. Appreciate that. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Chairman. I'm Jill Morgan, Lynn County Juvenile Department, and since I'm on the record, I want it noted that I am on my own time. This is important enough for me to come here and visit with you nice people and hopefully to make a change. My job is varied. You've heard all this. I'm ongoing. I work with ongoing youth, adjudicated for the most part. I love that. I like having a varied job. I like doing different things. I think it helps the community. My job takes me from intake to investigating a youth and his family and history to court. You know, I have to present cases before the court. So I go from the way I investigate to, you know, having to go take a kid into custody for a probation violation, which I had to do last Wednesday, who struggled. And, you know, my partner and I had to basically do what we needed to do to take him into custody. One thing, most of my complaints have been addressed, and I don't want to be redundant, but one thing I do want to mention is with Measure 11 now, youth that are 15 years and older are treated as adults. I've had several kids who, you know, were 15 and older and ended up being charged with Measure 11 offenses. Basically, at that point in time, when they're 15 and they're looking at, you know, 5 years, 10 months, or 7 years, 6 months, they don't have a whole heck of a lot to lose. And I've been covered in the blood of one of the kids that was in that position. Fortunately, he didn't have any diseases. The next time, that might not be the case. Yesterday, I was transporting a youth to Portland to a treatment facility with Oregon Youth Authority worker that's in probation or parole. He's covered under police and fire. I'm not. I don't know what the difference is. I'll tell you what the difference is from my perspective. When he receives a case, that kid has been examined by everybody. There's usually evaluations galore, and his problems and issues have pretty much been identified. When I receive a case, it's unknown. You know, I'm going in blind. So I appreciate your time today, and we have two folks here that work in Lynn County Detention, and I think you'll be interested in what they're
doing. Okay, thank you very much. Good afternoon.
My name is Amy Schumacher. I work at the Linda and Juvenile Detention Center in Albany. And I would just like, in the sense of Ms. Morgan here, to demonstrate another difference between Oregon Youth Authority and county. We are located within an OYA facility, which is Oak Creek Youth Corrections. We operate a unit. We take our kids in from the police officers. We pull weapons and drugs, as you heard, off of these kids. These kids can be intoxicated, high, detoxing. Before they go over to OYA, these kids are completely detoxed. They've had a full psychological evaluation. All medication has been started to control behavior issues with these youth. That's what we deal with these kids when they're at the most volatile point in their lives. One of my coworkers is here, and she's going to tell you a time that happened that she got hurt on the job. Thank you for your time.
Thank you very much.
Hi, I'm Kendra Soto. I get up every morning and I go to work. I don't know if I'm going to deal with the out-of-control youth or if I'm going to have a fine day. On August 8th, 1998, I went to work, and I had to deal with an out-of-control youth. I had to restrain her. I had to escort her to the floor. As a result of that, I tore my rotator cuff. In November, I had surgery to repair that, and now I have a scar. You can see. I deal with out-of-control youth. And like my coworker said, we deal with kids who come off the streets who we don't know if they have a disease, if they're detoxing, if they're high, we don't know. Thank you for your time.
Well, thank you very much. Okay. Appreciate that. Okay, so we have, I think John should, yeah, we've had John. Okay, you're going to wind up? Okay.
Finish up.
All right.
Sheriff Kirsten Duncan. We just want to say that certainly we would appreciate the support for this bill in this session. We recognize the reality that it may not pass. Certainly we would want to see the haphazard system that we currently have looked at to see if there couldn't be a change to set criteria that the PERS board itself could use to determine who should be in PERS and who should in police and fire and who should not be. So my hope would be that this bill passes, if it goes to the floor and passes. If it is not, certainly we would hope that in the future there could be a more reasoned approach to determine police and fire. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. Any questions from members of the committee or to have them here?
I just, yes. Mr. Chair, want to thank all of them for coming. I really appreciate the testimony and the descriptions of what life is really like.
Yeah.
Mr. Chair, I just want to say they certainly made their case. Yeah. Their jobs are as full of risk as any of the jobs, certainly riskier than even legislators who are covered in it.
They're very deserving.
Ours is getting riskier all the time.
There are some people who aren't so deserving.
Maybe we'll make a trade. Yeah. Mr. Smith, if you would like to comment.
Question?
Okay.
No.
I'd like to know that you're always going to ask some questions. Well, Mary, why don't you come forward? Mary, you...
I'll find somebody if I don't know.
Yeah. So Mary understands being brief, right?
Thanks.
Because I'm going to close this at 3:40.
Okay.
You mentioned the 50,000 employees. But I'd like to know exactly how many employees at the detention facilities and employees also county juvenile department. How many are there? And also second question, how many are the employees that covered under this position? How many are not? So actually what numbers are we talking about?
Mr. Chair, Senator Lim, can we get back to you about the breakout specifically? Thank you.
Mary, I think along the same lines, and maybe, Senator, as I mentioned, it somehow or other, I would hope that during an interim, and I don't know whether there will be an interim committee, what's going to happen, whether we could take it on. I'd like to relook at all of these numbers, because we've had a number of groups in during this session, and I'd like to take a look at all of those numbers and the different cases and what occurs and see if we can't look at the big picture on this whole thing, because I think it's really deserving some real attention. I think you have do you want to step forward? Do you have any other statement you want to make?
We have 9 employees and we're all under PERS. So in Multnomah County, we're all members. I wanted to add one thing. Are you all aware of Measure 11?
Yeah.
I'm sure you are. In Multnomah County, as of the day before yesterday, we hold 21 of those Measure 11 youth in our custody until they are found guilty of the crime that they and they're remanded to the adult. So we hold and we regard we have had up in our custody up to 33. I just wanted to add Measure 11.
Okay, well, thank you very much. And Mary, I think if we can get some of those figures, looking at the big picture down the road, I'd like to do that.
Senator, I think it's what makes sense. I mean, you're making a lot of sense about doing some more in-depth work in the interim, because I think that one of the problems that we've had is really systematically defining who's in and who's out. I mean, people who are in police and fire are reluctant to step forward for fear that somehow they will lose their police and fire because of the folks doing the same job that aren't in. And
all right, sure as well, sure.
We're not interested in risking anybody else's police and fire because we think the whole group deserves
the big picture.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much. Thanks to all of you for coming today, and good luck. And I realize that,
yes, can I make a final comment?
Final comment?
I want to especially thank you from the people of Multnomah County. we share more juvenile criminals in our district, and I want to thank you for the work you're doing anyway. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you folks very much. Okay, I'm going to close the... Well, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 898. Okay, I'm now going to open a public hearing on Senate Bill 671. Senator Ferrioli.
Chairman.
Good afternoon, Senator. Nice to have you with us.
Ted Ferrioli, State Senator from the Senate District 28. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, for allowing the hearing to proceed, and thanks to your staff for helping me dash all over the building and get amendments to my bill. Let me give you a brief presentation of why I brought this bill before the committee. And Senate Bill 671 would require our state agencies to keep an index of intergovernmental agreements. And this would provide basic information about the parties to the agreement, the date, and the purpose of the agreement. It's one of the interesting and burgeoning areas of government. We all know that the fastest growing area of government has been administrative law. But there's a corollary, and that is interagency and intergovernmental agreements between jurisdictions. These agreements don't enlarge the scope of the authority of the agency. Almost always they're directed at increasing the efficiency of the state agency. But they do require a commitment of financial and human resources and an agreement to cooperate for objectives that are mutual to the state agencies or to the state and local governments or to the municipalities, counties, state governments, and sometimes to federal agencies. But incredibly, no one in state government can tell me how many agencies have agreements. Nobody can tell me how many agreements there are. And nobody can tell me by subject what agreements are in force. So we sort of tumbled into this area when we started looking at trying to manage for this. And we discovered that there may be literally hundreds of agreements that are already in force between state agencies, and we just have no way, even by asking the agency, how many agreements do you have? We don't know. We even keep an index. We don't track the interagency agreements. We don't know by subject matter, by date, by agency, how to reference those agreements. We sign them, we file them. And I guess I'm curious to know how the agencies can meet their mission and keep their obligations under the agreements if they don't know what they're obligated to. So I've suggested in the bill that the Department of Administrative Service keep an index by subject matter, agreement, date, and by parties to the agreement. Not more rigorous than that, just a Dewey Decimal System, if you will, the subject matter index, so that we can, as legislators and as administrators of our state agencies, look up what agreements might be enforced. As originally proposed, Senate Bill 671 would have been a daunting and miserable task for state agencies to try to accomplish, because the scope of the bill was too broad, and it was focused upward and not inward. We would have had federal agency agreements, but no local.
Was it also retroactive?
It was retroactive to 5 years, and that would have caused people to delve into files they hadn't looked at for 5 years. With the assistance of the Legislative Council, we vastly narrowed the scope and scale of the bill. And we're hoping that the committee will look at the Dash-3 amendment, which talks about asking the Department of Administration to get a file within 30 days of an agreement being signed. That gives a month for the agency to send the copy. And that there be an index created with just the name, dates, and subject matter of the agreement. It deletes the more odious dates and times that were required before. And it also talks about then limiting these things that might sunset, so except when an agreement is extended or renewed before December 31st, an agreement under the ORS chapters that's entered into by an agency before the effective date of this act terminates not later than December 31st, 2001. We tried to narrow the scope of the effective date a little bit. We weren't asking for a five-year retroactive, but most of this is prospective. And the idea being that we still need to know at some point in time what agreements are out there. And I guess I would ask this organization, the committee, to move the bill forward with a due pass recommendation with the referral to Ways and Means. We don't know how much it's going to cost, but we need to have an idea of what it will cost, what the budget implications are. But it's my hope to put the executive branch on notice that they can't keep signing the agreements and not keep track of them. Just probably not a very efficient policy. And we can't do our jobs without having an idea of what our agencies are already obligated to do. We go out and create statutes very likely to address the same objects that we haven't done already by a mutual agreement. And potentially this could save as much money as it costs.
Basically meant just to be a recording and a record, an index. It's not a we have to get permission kind of thing to do this. So.
Mr. Chairman, to Senator Trill, the bill requires only an index memorial of the bill, of the agreement, be available. And actually, it's just a roadmap to the list of the intergovernmental.
And we could start, and she would just start to on the enactment of the bill.
Senator Duncan, I'll defer to Administrator Taylor because she was instrumental in helping me bring amendments forward.
Sure, Duncan, members of the committee, it's my understanding that included in this index would be all agreements that are currently active, and then from the effective date of the bill, all agencies that have agreements would have to submit them to GAAP for indexing.
Now, that would be a retroactive effect.
It would be retroactive, but only for those agreements that are still active. We wouldn't want, it's my understanding that they would not collect agreements that are not active. And then there is a provision in the Dash 3 amendment that would require confirmation or reconfirmation of those active agreements by December 31st of 2001 so that we know somebody out there recognizes that this is indeed in effect.
Mr. Chairman, so two principles, actually three at work here. First of all, we want to get the agencies to come forward and talk about what this would cost, and there may be further amendments in a future process.
That's what I was going to say, Senator. Are you available to stick around for a few minutes?
Oh, boy. Okay. You bet I am.
Well, why don't I just ask Cam Rennie to join you at the table?
And then the other two principles, Mr. Yes. Chairman, there is a retroactive principle, but the idea is if we didn't have these reenacted, some of these intergovernmental agreements are still in effect and have no use to the agency. So over a two-year period, let's take a look at the intergovernmental agreements we have. If you do nothing, they just go away. If you re-up them or re-sign them or re-initial them between the two agency heads, then you put them in the index. And then people at least know they're available.
Yeah. I'm going to ask Cam to come forward.
Senator, you mentioned how difficult it was and that they didn't even know what they had and so forth. As they do this review of the existing ones, if they don't find one that's still in effect immediately, let's say, and don't get it on the first list, they didn't neglect it or didn't deliberately do that.
Actually, Mr. Chairman, the penalty is a complete rescission of all the allocations and budgetary appropriations that have been made to the agency retroactive to the date. No. Mr. Chairman, to Senator Trill, there is no penalty for failure to observe. The idea is to create the information.
I think it's really good to have the information. No doubt.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cam Burney. I'm with the Department of Administrative Services. We came before this committee a few weeks ago to talk about the bill as the original version, which then spoke only to interstate and international agreements. Brought forward a representative of the Department of Justice. This is bringing us all up to date. To say, well, gee whiz, Department of Justice is already keeping its own files, its own indexes, and is charged with reviewing those kinds of contracts anyway, international, interstate. And we were talking about if this bill should go forward, that we could provide some amendments that would allow DOJ rather than DAS to perform that duty. With the statutory amendments, that changed somewhat. With the inclusion beyond interstate and international of intergovernmental, finding out that this hearing would be held, and I'm getting my hands on the statutory amendments a short while ago, yesterday, I made a few calls to a few agencies, including Department of Human Resources, who traffics quite actively in intergovernmental agreements.
What have we asked Don to come up to?
Yes, Don Charlton with Department of Human Resources can perhaps characterize his volumes. For us to come up with a fiscal impact, we have to know how many are out there ourselves. So I put a call into Human Resources. I also had a call into ODOT. We in the Department of Administrative Services are somewhat active, especially in my division, which includes motor pool, surplus property, where we have a number of agreements with local governments relating to selling their property on their behalf and so on, allowing them to buy out the bulk price agreements and so on and so forth. And I estimate that we're probably somewhere loosely between 200 and 400 of those agreements. But yet, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we don't know. We have no reason to ask, because those particular kinds of agreements are not subject to purchasing review. They go through other reviews within agencies. And that concludes my remarks.
I'm trying to think what you said, though,
okay,
about whether you would be supporting.
Okay, in summary, with the Dash-3. It's a Dash-3. We have no position on this Dash-3. We're neither for nor against. I'm just kind of saying that before we come up with the fiscal impact, we have to know ourselves how many such agreements there are out there.
Okay. Don, do you want to grab
a question?
Come on up and be ready to get a question.
Yes, yes.
How onerous do you think this will be as a task? Senatorial is right. It's a good thing to know what those agreements are and have some record of them. But what sort of task are we asking of you?
Chair, Senator Schroed, to characterize, we won't be the ones to know whether these contracts, we will only be tracking and filing and indexing those which come our way. Mm-hmm. We won't be able to tell the agencies, well, what about this, what about this, because we don't know about those other agreements.
So I just ask them to tell you what they've got.
Yes. Yeah.
Okay.
So
they should be able to do that at least.
I don't think a piece-by-piece incremental analysis of bill will be that difficult. The question just remains how many there are. So the way the bill designs the indexing, I think there's three different criteria. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Cam Burney. I'm with the Department of Administrative Services. We came before this committee a few weeks ago to talk about the bill as the original version, which then spoke only to interstate and international agreements. Brought forward representative of the Department of Justice, just bringing us all up to date, to say, well, gee whiz, Department of Justice is already keeping its own files, its own indexes, and is charged with reviewing those kinds of contracts anyway, international, interstate. And we were talking about if this bill should go forward, that we could provide some amendments that would allow DOJ rather than DAS to perform that duty. With the Dash-3 amendments, that changed somewhat. With the inclusion beyond interstate and international of intergovernmental, finding out that this hearing would be held, and I'm getting my hands on the Dash-3 amendments a short while ago, yesterday, I made a few calls to two agencies, including Department of Human Resources, who traffics quite actively in intergovernmental agreements.
What have we asked Don to come up to?
Yes, Don Charlton with Department of Human Resources perhaps characterized his volume, because for us to come up with a fiscal impact, we have to know how many are out there ourselves. So I put a call into Human Resources. I also had a call into ODOT. We in the Department of Administrative Services are somewhat active, especially in my division, which includes purchasing, motor pool, surplus property, where we have a number of agreements with local governments relating to selling their property on their behalf and so on, allowing them to buy off of our price agreements and so on and so forth. And I estimate that we're probably somewhere loosely between 200 and 400 of those agreements. But yet, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we don't know. We have no reason to have asked, because those particular kinds of agreements are not subject to purchasing review. They go through other reviews within agencies. And that concludes my remarks.
I'm trying to think what you said, though,
okay,
about whether you would be supporting.
Okay, in summary, the dash three. The dash three, we have no position on this dash three. We're neither for nor against. I'm just kind of saying that before we come up with the fiscal impact, we have to know ourselves how many such agreements there are out there.
Okay. Don, do you want to grab what you come on up and be ready to get a question?
Yes, yes.
How onerous do you think this will be as a task?
Senator Perry always right. It's a good thing to know what those agreements are and have some record of them. But what sort of task are we asking?
Mr. Chair, Senator Schroed, to characterize, we won't be the ones to know whether these contracts, we will only be tracking and filing and indexing those which come our way.
Mm-hmm.
We won't be able to tell the agencies, well, what about this, because we don't know about those other agreements.
So I can just ask them to tell you what they've got.
Yes, yes.
Okay.
So
they should be able to do that, at least.
I don't think a piece-by-piece incremental analysis of this will be that difficult. The question just remains how many there are. Well, the way the bill designs the indexing, I think there's three different criteria, isn't that right, Senator?
Date, object, and party to.
Yes, that sounds fairly good.
So you don't have to have the contract in hand or anything else.
Mr. Chairman, to Senator Schroed's observation, we'd just like to let people know where to look. If they thought an intergovernmental agreement might have an impact on some issue that affects them.
Don, do you want to go ahead and speak to you?
Yes, I. My name's Don Charlton. I'm the Chief Financial Officer for Human Resources, one of the largest writers of contracts in the state. At the risk of contradicting a little bit, let me give you an idea of numbers that DHR has. We have 208 interagency agreements, 629 intergovernmental, 7 interstate, 12 international, which does include some tribes. They're treated as international governments at times, and 3 tribal agreements. I also supervise a central contract with DHR. We do track this kind of information, and to the specific level that is asked for in this bill. Information is my business, and I agree with the intent of the bill to gather the information. The one comment I'd have on this is the paper flow that it seems to create. With 859 contracts, that's a lot of paper. And then many of these intergovernmental, like for the mental health contract, et cetera, we're amending those on a monthly basis, and I would assume that it speaks to that as well.
Let me ask you, what about things that are amended? Do you want to
Mr. Chairman, to Senator Schroed's question, we try to do the right thing. We certainly don't want to increase the blizzard of paperwork between agencies. The intent in bringing the legislation forth is not to capture contracts per se, but agreements between two governmental entities that may have an effect on public policy or allocation of resources. So
it's possible that the definition of intergovernmental agreement needs to be narrowed and focused. The idea that you could do this transfer of information with an electronic transfer, you certainly don't need to generate a lot of paperwork. It's just the idea that somewhere... Right, and I guess I'm pretty impressed that agencies, that several agencies of the over 100 that the state operates probably know every agreement and what's in it and who's a party to it and the date of the sign. Others, I think, probably will not know. But the point of the bill is that I don't know, and I don't know where to look. And I guess it would be good for me to be able to know at least where to look.
Let me make one more comment, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. One of the things I like to point out that Cam pointed out, these contracts don't automatically go to DAS for review. These are not a procurement type of contract, so it isn't something that they would normally touch. Just to support that, these agreements generally do all go to DOJ, and I don't know which central agency would take that on. The one kind of concern I have is, I'd like to minimize the impact on central agencies because the success of my business is very dependent upon CAM's capacity and Donald and the DOJ folks. So I'd love to work with this and get the information that's requested while minimizing that impact so that their capacity is available to support our operations.
Well, let's check on a smaller agency who probably doesn't have any contracts. How does that affect you, Brad?
Members of the committee, Grant and Karen, representing the Oregon University System. We did appear at your first hearing and hope that the bill could be streamlined. Let me repeat for the record that we are in the concept of having a registry is a good idea, of having an index. We want to cooperate in doing that and appreciate the sponsors' advocacy in that regard. But in the Dash 3, we have a bill which was bigger than it was the last time we saw it, and still requiring dual activity with central agencies, and would suggest that rather than DAS, for our purposes, DOJ, because that's where all ours go now. Legal sufficiency at a minimum, if not for higher review regarding intergovernmental and interstate or national agreements that are between federal government to government. With the Dash 3, we are now extending this to a much larger group of intergovernmental agreements which we enter into. We have six campuses which have colleges of education, which have contracts with school districts for placement of student teachers at various schools. So there are literally hundreds of those, none of which go to DAS or to DOJ, which would come under this. We have many others that, each of the campuses have with their local agencies for cooperation, city, county, school district, others, which would not go to DOJ or to DAS, which would now be included in this. So we argue for one repository, one index, DOJ, volunteering for somebody else's agency, but they're already doing a lot of the work now, and I can say that with some authority because they're going to bill us for the work, and that would be a way to accomplish it and give folks the index that they're looking for. I think that would be my advice, at least from our agency. We'd have one source, we'd know where they went, we'd have the index. We're already doing that for much of our work now. This would expand the work that would be covered, but we would be able to capture all of that too and send it to one place.
I shouldn't say all go to the archives.
They are all subject to retention records statutes which are enforced, much of which are archived. But they're in the archives of all the agencies that are going there. The person would have to spend a very long time seeking out individual government agreements in the archive material for various agencies. So we're still
still in favor of the concept, have no objection to the idea, think it's a good thing for to provide public information. There's a right to know, which ought to be honored, but for administrative ease, take the registry at the agency that's getting most of them now and not duplicate them, because we'll still send it to DOJ, and now we'll also have to send it to DAS, which is a workload issue and a cost issue, which has an impact.
Mr. Chairman, that sounds like the product of a great suggestion, and I did not connect the idea with the legal sufficiency review of the Department of Justice as being a pinch point where you could capture that information, but I would think any agreement between governments or government agencies that rises to the level of the requirement for a legal sufficiency review wouldn't be so impactful that we'd be necessarily interested in capturing after the index. If it does need a legal review, it's probably something that people ought to be able to look at if they needed to. So if DOJ has that function, that role, that sounds like a great suggestion for the repository of the information. So I would gather, since they've had a hard copy of the agreement to review, maybe even it would be available from that agency. So.
Senator, especially my colleagues, what I would like to do on this, since it seems to me as if you're moving towards some agreement, I really like to let you see that and close the public hearing today. I'll request an extension for a work session on Tuesday. That would give you a chance to get together and come back with some amendments for us on Tuesday. I'm watching your expression.
Sure, well, that's fine. I was just thinking it might be something if we send the bill amended and send it to Ways and Means that the LFO couldn't handle it.
Our problem is we don't have a work session schedule.
Oh, okay.
That's my problem. So I've got to ask for an extension. Okay. And while we're at it, I thought maybe that would give us a couple of days if we want to come back with amendments.
Whatever you want to do.
And we can do it either way. You know, we can come back with a work session on Tuesday and send it to
Mr. Chairman, I'll gladly see you Tuesday if you will allow me to do the work group today. That's great. I would really appreciate it. The fact of the matter is that earlier the bill seemed to have such broad implications, and the issue really is just to try to get the information. The DOJ nexus might be the solution, but I'd be interested in talking to other state agencies that also generate a lot of intergovernmentalism. The natural resource agencies just have lots of them. And so do probably all the other states have occasion to use. We just don't have an index.
In that point of history, since this is part of the state's operational history, all of that information ought to get to archives somewhere.
That's why we keep a history professor on this committee.
The state library.
I think if you folks will come back in with that, I'm going to read your chest or something before I close it.
Except, Mr. Chairman, don't let us
hang out,
please.
I won't do that. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Lynn Rossick from the Department of Justice. And as you recall, I was here a couple of weeks ago when we discussed this bill. And at that time, I was authorized to say on behalf of the department under the original version that we would consider, if amendments were proposed to the bill, take on that task of the Department of Administrative Services. And I would be very happy to work with Senator Farioli as far as considering to look at this bill and to see what the impact would be. I believe that we would still have some concerns because of the fact that the new category of the intergovernmental agreement under 191.10 is
from my perspective, a large category, an important category, and one that is not now currently coming to the Department of Justice necessarily. Some are depending on the importance of the agreement or the agency's choice to have a review, and so that would be a workload issue. So I can't speak for the department right now on our position, but on behalf of the department, I can say that we would be happy to work with the senator on reviewing this further.
Oh, okay. With my committee concurs, what we'll say to you is I will appeal for extension and tell him this is, I'll say to the president, this is an urgent matter. And you'll come back on Tuesday, and when you come back in on Tuesday, we'll have complete agreement on the amendments coming before. It'll just be a matter of tapping and getting it out right quick like, and we'll be happy to deal with it.
Well, that's the same one.
Okay? That's it. It's in your hands.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate the committee's efforts, and thank you in advance for your cooperation on Tuesday, and I appreciate the willingness of the folks from the agency still working with us.
Thank you, sir. I think it's your congeniality that helps the progress, so thank you. Okay, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 671. For your information, folks, anyone who might be in the room, we have Senate Bill 486 scheduled. It's last on the agenda. I'm shooting now for 4:45 on that particular bill. Senator Lim has to be gone until that point, so we'll be getting to centers to Senate Bill 486 at 4:45. Okay. I'm now going to open a public hearing. I think I'm going to take 1071, 72, 73. Do you want to take them together?
Yeah, the public hearing part?
Well, yes.
Okay.
Okay. I'm going to open a public hearing part on Senate Bills 1071, 1072, and 1073. And any last-minute things you want to discuss with us, and I may have a couple of questions for people in the audience too.
As whatever witnesses come forward, you can call witnesses forward. I wanted to just make a couple comments,
yes.
And I'll keep them very brief. Yes. You want to invite some people forward while they're getting that right now. I wanted to say that it's probably my fault, but I last week thought that was the only public hearing we have, and I didn't realize that there was going to be more public hearing today. So I didn't invite many people that wanted to come, and last week, as you remember, I told you that I probably could have filled the room with homeless advocates and so on, but I didn't. We limited that to about 10 people from various agencies and just tried to make it a cross-section. Having said that, I don't have more people who are advocates here today, though we could have. I also wanted to say that I took the amendments that you'll see before you in 1071 right from the kind of the wording that the city attorney wanted.
The attorney from
Portland. Nevertheless, the city and police are here to testify against the bill. So I think we ought to just get on with the testimony and see what comes from it.
Okay. I think I think we should. So people who are here for the first time today don't think that there's no support for the bill. This room was very crowded last week, and I think we've made an effort to try to hear from everyone. So I think the impact of that group is very clear, at least it is with me.
Thank
you. Let's see. Right now I have, on 1071, I have Mark. Do you want to come on up? Oh, okay. Commander Kaufman and Commander Grubb. I have all three of you at the same time here. Thank you. Well, you picked a good day to be here.
Yes, sir. Unfortunately, it's certainly the outside.
You mean, are you trying to tell us if you're going to be outside than with us?
Oh, no.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Mr. Chair.
Mr.
Chair, members of the committee, Mark Landauer with the City of Portland's Office of Government Relations. I'm joined today with Commander Grubb and Commander Kaufman from the Portland Police Bureau. We've come here to testify in opposition to the aforementioned bill. We've come to testify in opposition to the bill before you today. I'll briefly just make a couple highlights why we are in opposition to these bills, and we'd be, of course, happy to answer any questions that you have, and Commander Grubb and Kaufman can further elaborate the reasoning behind our opposition to these bills. Senate Bill 1070, let me interrupt myself here. I should thank Senator Shields as well. He's been very kind and gracious to us in the discussions about these bills. He's a very, very strong advocate for people of lesser means, and we certainly respect him for that and commend him for his efforts. Senate Bill 1071 would require 24-hour posted notice prior to the issuance of citations to homeless individuals for trespassing or camping on public property. We feel that this is an unnecessary and unworkable bill. It is the policy of the Portland Police Bureau to ensure that ensures the fair, courteous, and equal treatment of all people without homes and with handling illegal campers at campsites. Furthermore, the Portland Police Bureau, under the general orders which I've provided you today, have been instructed to take into account consideration the weather in conjunction with the capabilities of referral services when addressing illegal campers. This bill would prevent us from issuing citations to individuals unless the site has been posted 24 hours in advance. Now, this is why we believe the bill is unworkable. Our experience has shown that posting these notifications at the campsite are often removed, destroyed, what have you, and it's very difficult to be sure that these individuals have been notified or are aware when those notification sheets have been destroyed or removed, what have you, that it has been posted. If we were to come in there and then make a citation, issue a citation, which we loathe to do, but we do it in certain circumstances, they could certainly claim that the notification was not provided, excuse me. On 1072, would prohibit the removal of a homeless individual if adequate shelter space is unavailable. Our problem with this, among other things, is from an enforcement perspective. How is an officer supposed to know whether or not a shelter space is available? For example, is an officer supposed to call around throughout the city to try to find available shelter for an individual, for example, taking him away from his other duties at the time, and perhaps being diverted from urgent police needs in other areas? We've already spent millions of dollars on homeless shelters in the city, and they're often filled to capacity. Are we to spend millions more to ensure that we can clear out an illegal campsite, for example? Furthermore, this bill would permit an individual from being prevent an individual from being removed from a campsite if he or she is unwilling to move to a shelter for personal reasons. These personal reasons could be anything and would make the ordinance that we currently have in the city of Portland simply unworkable. For example, if someone decided to set up a camp in City Hall, and I know that I'm going to extremes here, there was no available shelter space, we'd not be able to remove that person because of personal reasons. I realize I'm going to extremes here, but it's just simply to illustrate an example. Finally, on Senate Bill 1073, if this bill were adopted, it virtually negate Portland's anti-camping ordinance by prohibiting a municipality or county government from imposing a civil penalty or fine on a homeless individual for trespassing or camping on public property. Therefore, if a homeless person wanted to camp out in City Hall on a city sidewalk or pitch a tent on Waterfront Park in the city of Portland, we would be powerless to remove them unless some other criminal activity were involved. I realize these are far-fetched far-fetched examples. Nevertheless, there are examples that very well could come true if these bills were passed. I thank you very much, and with turnover to Officer Commander Gruff and Commander Kaufman. Thank you.
Thank you, Commander Gruff. Could you please identify yourself for the record?
Yes, sir, if I could. Commander Kaufman, please.
Okay.
Yeah, my name is Bob Kaufman. I'm the commander of Central Precinct, which is all the policing on the west side of the river, Mr. Chair. What I wanted to share with the committee today are a number of issues that I find, again, that are unworkable in these bills. One is that what this says to me and my officers, the one that deals with issuing of trespass citations, is that in Central Precinct, where we have literally dozens and dozens of homeless youth and adults come into the precinct looking for assistance and looking for a place to stay, if they start to act out on us, we cannot exclude those folks from the precinct because it's public property. But what it does allow us to do is exclude you. It allows us to take you into custody and cite you for trespass because you're not a homeless person. You know, so that's one of the things that tells me here. The second thing is that
we used before this committee right quick like that for that.
Right.
Well, I don't want to do that.
No, but I'm sure you understand
I got
the point. And we use that on occasion when we do get folks that are basically disruptive, not only in the precincts, in the police precinct, but in City Hall and Public Library up on 10th Avenue and places like that. And essentially the way we enforce that is we say, you know, you have to kind of behave yourself and you know, not yell and scream and curse, or you're going to be arrested for trespass. And sometimes we get to that point. You know, let's get to the homeless issue. One of the things that we've been working very, very hard in the city of Portland on is dealing with homeless youth issues. In Central Precinct, for example, we have a rather unique program that has been brought to the attention of many, many agencies throughout the United States, is that we actually have social workers that work in my precinct that represent New Avenues for Youth, which is a homeless youth advocate organization in downtown Portland, where we actually take kids who are homeless or who are status offenders, release them from any police custody, and release them into this organization so they can find the care for these kids and an appropriate place for them to go. We're already doing these sorts of things where we're at right now. And my biggest concern there is that really homeless youth are not only getting into trouble, but they're being victimized at a substantial rate, and that's what my major concern is here. So that's why I instruct my officers to deal with the camps in certain locations. But in other locations, for example, in Northwest Portland and Cooch Park area, most of my responses, my officers' responses to homeless camping really comes from neighborhood concerns and neighborhood associations and individuals who call to say that they were walking through a particular park and they were finding needles and cardboard and old clothes and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and they were frightened to use their parks. You know, would you please come up and help us? We use this as a tool on occasion, and most of the time we do not actually cite folks for illegal camping. We either talk to them and get them hooked up with some programs that Commander Grubbs can surely share with you that he developed on the east side, over in Senator Shields' area of interest, or they you know, they take off on us, and on occasion, those folks are taken into custody, and usually they're taken into custody for other sorts of criminal acts, you know, and not homelessness, and not certainly camping. You know, we've had this camping ordinance now for well over 15, 16 years that I know of, and we have rarely actually cited anybody or actually taken anybody into custody for illegal camping. The poaching issue is terribly, terribly problematic for us. I've got three officers that do this practically for a living.
We posted a number of sites at the request of the community and the community organizations and business organizations. Those sites are torn down, and we have a terrible and difficult time trying to develop a legal standard for knowledge that this was an illegal campsite on the people that we are talking to start with. And we haven't solved that yet. We've been working with the Oregon Department of Transportation and our own Department of Transportation and other groups to try to solve this. But what we see in these three bills, the way they're crafted, at least now, is that we see that essentially the camping ordinance that we have in the city of Portland is going to be gutted, and we're going to be relatively powerless to assist our associations, our neighborhoods, our school districts in keeping this problem relatively cleaned up. you know, these sorts of things where we're at right now. With most of the, and my biggest concern there is that really homeless youth are not only getting into trouble, but they're being victimized at a substantial rate, and that's what my major concern is here. So that's why I instruct my officers to deal with the camps in certain locations. But in other locations, for example, in Northwest Portland and Cooch Park area, most of my responses, my officers' responses to homeless camping, really comes from neighborhood concerns and neighborhood associations and individuals who call to say that they were walking through a particular park and they were finding needles and cardboard and old clothes and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and they were fighting to use their parks. And would you please come up and help us? We use this as a tool on occasion, and most of the time we do not actually cite folks for illegal camping. We either talk to them and get them hooked up with some programs that Commander Grubbs can surely share with you that he developed on the east side, in fact, over in Senator Shields' area of interest. They take off on us, and on occasion, those folks are taken into custody. And usually they're taken into custody for other sorts of criminal acts, you know, and not homelessness, and not certainly camping. We've had this camping orders now for well over 15, 16 years that I know of, and we have rarely actually cited anybody or actually taken anybody into custody for illegal camping. The posting issue is terribly, terribly problematic for us. I've got three officers that do this practically for a living. We've posted a number of sites at the request of the community and the community organizations and business organizations. Those sites are torn down, and we have a terribly difficult time trying to develop a legal standard for knowledge that this was an illegal campsite on the people that we are talking to start with. And we haven't solved that yet. We've been working with the Oregon Department of Transportation and our own Department of Transportation and other groups to try to solve this. But what we see in these three bills, the way they're crafted, at least now, is that we see that essentially the camping ordinance that we have in the city of Portland is going to be gutted, and we're going to be relatively powerless to assist our associations, our neighborhoods, our school districts in keeping this problem relatively cleaned up.
Thank you, Commander.
Thank you.
Sir Duncan,
Chair Duncan, members of the committee, my name is Sam Grubbs. I'm the commander of Southeast Precinct. I would like to point out for over 40 years, people have always forgotten the S at the end of my name. It is Grubbs, plural. In the 2.5 years that I've been in Southeast Precinct, this has been an issue that has been of such great community concern. It is always a topic at neighborhood associations, business associations, and it is something that is very much of the interest of citizens that have called me regarding my testimony here today. I'd like to address a point, though, that came up earlier by a statement by Chris from Senator Shields regarding advocacy. I think you're looking at a group of persons, myself and Commander Kaufman, that there is no more stubborn animal in the world than a police officer. And understanding that we always believe there's only one way to address a community livability problem, and that's either through enforcement and or let's put additional resources. Amazingly, we've learned that's not always the best way to do business. And through a unique program that was thought out, designed, and through partnerships with not only some of the local churches, with the homeless advocacy groups, but we've discovered we no longer need 22 police officers to do what was used to be called camp sweeps, or the cleanups, or to utilize public services or dump trucks, or to get officers injured by lifting items or picking up needles, or getting into hazardous sites. What we did is we coordinated and we learned of a program through on the east side that is located at St. Francis Parish, run by a very unique gentleman, very much an advocate for the homeless, called JOIN. And someone asked me what the acronym means, and sir, I cannot tell you that. It is a Center for Advocacy. Every time I ask Mr. Rob Justice he tells me it's a center for advocacy. It is a fantastic program. There should be more of them. It's patterned off a program used in California where this very same problem was identified, was found that we cannot continue to throw the enforcement efforts in, that it was a vicious circle, the burden on the judicial system of the posting, of the taking of property, the lawsuits, the complaints against officers. It was an antagonistic system. I was very fortunate to have an officer that is now a sergeant with Commander Kaufman's precinct that sought these people out, that we developed this partnership. And we were hesitant. Granted, we were very skeptical because we believed that there was only one way, and that was through posting, enforcement, you know, citation, whatever the case may be. But we have found by utilizing this program and others, we have also discovered through Hispanic Access Program, through the Oregon Human Development Commission, they have a program that targets Hispanic homeless persons. Particularly in my precinct, I have a large congregation of day laborers. Many are homeless. I have now joined, excuse the expression, join with Hispanic Access so that they're not at cross-competing purposes. Through our partnership with JOIN, with the other services, sir, we no longer need to go through a 24-hour posting. We no longer need to worry about illegal camping citations. We are able to make one phone call, one officer, and ask them, would you check this location that this business community or this neighborhood association has complained about? And they provide us the feedback. We're realistic knowing that their resources are limited. As addressed in Mr. Landauer's handout to you, are certain things that occurred last year in a subcommittee meeting. At this point in time, we police are believers. It's not the end. We are more advocates now, frankly, than perhaps some of the advocates, you know, on what needs to be done. It is a social problem. It is a community problem. However, it is an issue that if these bills are passed, it impedes the progress that we've made and how we can go forward in the future. We realize that enforcement is not the answer, but we cannot have persons that are chronic, and yet there are chronic homeless people that refuse the services, that continue to either engage in illegal activities or drugs or other problems, that the tool of either the camping ordinance or trespassing or other criminal charges, we need that tool to get them into a system, and again, there are people that we simply cannot access or reach. So I don't want the perception of the committee or anyone that we are not advocates. It took us, unfortunately, many years to realize that we can do something more efficient and a better use of the taxpayers' money. Thank you very much.
Okay, thank you very much, Commander Grubbs. Questions from the committee?
I don't really have any questions.
Thank you very much. Jerry,
Chairman,
you're welcome to take off. Okay.
Committee, my name is Jerry Bieberly, and I'm here today representing Oregon Coalition on Housing and Homelessness. You may have known us by our prior name, the Oregon Shelter Network, and I represent about 40 organizations that probably operate the majority, if not most of the homeless shelters in the state of Oregon. And I'm in here in support of Senate Bill 1071, with or without the amendments. And the bill is as is written, it's fine with me. I don't feel a need for the amendments, but if the committee wants the amendments, that's okay too. We worked with then-Representative Shield and Representative Tiernan, was it 4 years ago, I believe, that got the initial language that put in the 24-hour notice statute. And I was struck last week that when we did that, it was the Portland ordinance that was the model. We were all praising and saying what Portland's doing is just terrific. I wish that everybody else in the state of Oregon would do what Portland does. And then we were back here 4 years later, and then in this morality play of some kind, suddenly Portland became the villain, and I couldn't quite figure out what happened in that 4-year period.
So I talked to some folks and I said, what happened in that 4 years? And what's happened in that 4 years is the citations. It's not the sweeps. It's not the notification. It's suddenly homeless people were being cited for all practical purposes for being homeless. And then, so I went back to the original statute and looked at that again, and that's kind of what I passed out to you. And what's interesting is in the original statute, there's a section that's not printed on the bill because it's not germane to the bill, but section 203.077, halfway down right-hand page, number 2, says that you're supposed to implement the policy that's developed to ensure the most humane treatment for removal of homeless individuals, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And it seems to me giving them a $100 ticket on the way out the door isn't particularly humane. Now, I've heard the argument today that, well, we really don't cite for homelessness, we cite for something else. And I say, well, if that's the case, what's wrong with 1071? Because that's all it talks about. It doesn't say, there's nothing in 1071, there's nothing in the statute. In fact, the statute specifically says that if there's illegal activities or drugs or if there's a danger to health and safety, that the sweep can commence immediately. You don't have to wait 24 hours. And you'll find that at the bottom on the printed page, sub number 2, sub 8, right at the bottom of the page, and you put the page, there's the other exception. And there's nothing in the statute or in 1071 that says if there's something dangerous or illegal going on, that it prohibits the police at all from doing anything. So if indeed you have the police show up at a site and somebody is participating in an illegal activity, using drugs, in a fight, being violent, whatever, there's nothing in this bill, there's nothing in the statute that says the police can't act. All this bill says is you can't cite them for being homeless. And for that reason, I think it's a good bill and suggest that you move on. Thank you.
Questions for Jake? Anyone else? Is no one else assigned to testify?
I have staff here that can answer any questions you might have. But
I'm going to close the public hearing, man. I'll close the public hearing on Bill 1071, 1072, 1073. I'll open a work session on Senate Bill 1071.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
If we're doing this, I guess, in a careful manner, I guess I should remove the dash one amendments of 1071 for discussion purposes. Is that what we should do?
Let's do that.
This is the language suggested essentially by the city attorney of the city of Portland before they decided to just testify against the whole idea. What they do is, if you see it there, it says law enforcement officials shall post a notice written in English and Spanish 24 hours in advance of removing homeless individuals from an established campsite, issuing a citation to a homeless individual for camping on public property, or issuing a citation to a homeless individual for trespassing on public property. And I wish that the commanders and Mark had stayed. Oh, Mark's still here. I'm glad he's here. I wish the commanders had stayed because I totally agree that join is a better idea than the way they have done it. But please remember that last week join was here to testify in favor of these bills. And I'm sure they were unaware of that fact when they commented on join. It is a better idea to go that route. But all this does is it doesn't stop them from removing people. They can still do that. What it stops them from doing is walking in when you put up that notice and finding people that happen to be there at the time of the notice. And that's, I mean, Bob Tiernan and I had one successful cooperative adventure together. Okay? And that happened to be this bill. And I don't even know how that happened exactly, but he was interested in the bill, and I thought, hey, Sherry said I did that. Okay. I thought it was just kind of an interesting joining of two different worlds.
in some senses, and we had some fun with the bill, and he thought it was the right thing to do. But
so did it pass?
It passed. It became law, and you're looking at it right here. The law is that you can't just go in under a bridge or someplace and sweep a camp away without putting up a 24-hour notice. If you put up that notice and it comes down, you can still sweep the camp away after 24 hours. So what the police have done, essentially, is to go in, and when they post the notice, if anybody's there, they can give them a $100 fine at that moment. And that's where I think legislative intent was stood on its head. Okay? And that's why I'm asking that we adopt these Dash 1 amendments, which at least put it in the language that the city attorney asked for, and would bring the police to a point where they would take cognizance of legislative intent 4 years ago. I mean, you put up a 24-hour notice, there's nothing that would stop you 24 hours later if you want to go back and cite people or sweep the camp or remove the camp or whatever. But I think if you were here to vote on it then, I think the idea of putting up a notice and at the same time giving somebody a $100 fine because they happen to be at that homeless site, I think that's the legislative intent on the head.
Let's try the comment about City Hall. I mean, that was a...
I think that was a far-fetched example because there probably aren't that many better examples available. And the good lobbyists from the city, in fact, said it was a far-fetched example. The common occurrence is not going to be in City Hall or in Waterfront Park. Homeless people want to be in places where they're not noticed in most circumstances. I did a homeless count with Sisters of the Road Cafe about a month and a half ago. In fact, we did it on St. Patrick's Day. The places we went to count homeless people were in Northwest Portland, which is a pretty trendy area. And the people were incredibly well hidden. The only way we knew where to go to count those people was because we had some homeless people who were regulars at Sisters of the Road Cafe go with us and show us where those people are. You don't very often have homeless people involved in the kinds of scenarios here, and I wouldn't be surprised if there's a nuisance ordinance of some sort that could take care of the kind of example, far-fetched as it was, that has to do with the city of Portland.
Yes, this question, Senator. And we're in work session on 1071, but there's a relationship with 1072, 1073. Okay, as I listened to the commanders talk to us, and I'm like, yeah, I wish they were still here, I picked up a sense of concern and that they're trying to deal with things in a different way than they've done so before. Is that...
I think, and I wish they'd stayed, and I hope you'll tell them that I don't live in Southeast Portland anymore. I'm not the pastor of that church. It caused all that trouble over the years in Southeast, starting the first shelter in Southeast, so that they don't retaliate against my former neighborhood or whatever. But, you know,
Well, I guess what I'm saying, I detect this, a change of philosophy. Remember, I didn't hear it before, but based on what they were saying, how they did operate and how they are operating, a real change of philosophy,
yeah.
Change of action. And I guess the concern I have is I don't want to pull the rug from under them. I don't want to give them an impression that we don't want to support that movement. That's what I'm saying to all of you.
And I don't think that at least 1071 will do that. I don't think it'll change the new direction they're moving. And there's one reason. He commented about having to use 17 or 20 police officers with dump trucks and everything to sweep camps. Now what they're doing is much more... Well, I think it's very intelligent. They're joining with JOIN, and they have JOIN, which is the social service agency, and the people were here last week. They have them, with all of their connections and all their networks into the homeless community, go check out a campsite in a neighborhood or something and diffuse the situation in that neighborhood with the neighborhood association and so on. So you have maybe one police officer instead of 17 needed. And so you have the homeless advocates cleaning up a mess made by some homeless people rather than police. You have cooperation instead of confrontation. But nothing in this Senate Bill 1071 stops that from happening. Absolutely nothing. All this does is try to get it to the point where we're not standing legislative intent from just 4 years ago, Representative Tiernan's bill and my own, which went through both chambers of the House and Senate, and the governor signed it, and became law.
Everyone knows, and maybe Mark can answer this question for us. Okay, are we issuing citations on the first stop?
In the testimony that you have from Mark, he says that they've done about 25 citations. And
that's one of our articles there. 25 citations this...
In 96 and 97, it says on page 2, down 1, 2, 3, 4 paragraphs.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, Mark Landauer with the City of Portland. I believe that Senator Shields is referring to a portion of my testimony where I believe I stated that the Portland Police Bureau had issued approximately 25 citations for camping during 1996 and 1997. I believe it was in the Southeast Precinct alone. I'm going from memory there, but that's what I was informed of.
He did say also that most of them were for trespassing and drug charges and so on.
That is correct.
And this ordinance doesn't affect that at all. They can keep on doing that. In fact, if there is drugs or something else involved, the 24-hour notice is totally irrelevant. You know, you can, anytime you see that activity, you can cite that right then. This is just saying if it's just the homeless camp, don't go in to post a notice to sweep away a camp and cite people just because they happen to be in a homeless camp. How is a $100 fine going to help that person? You know,
it's a law specifically drawn, so it really does tie to camping. It's not trespassing in a public building or in a library.
Right. This has to do with homeless camping.
If
Jerry or any of the other experts sitting in the back of the room want to help me out, they're certainly welcome to.
In Mark's
testimony,
he describes it differently and says that would require 24-hour posted notice prior to issuing citation to homeless persons for trespassing or camping on public property. If that's the way it's described in the law, then it's pretty broad. But he may be wrong, and you're saying it's not described that way.
Chairman, Senator, first of all, it's not my bill. It's Senator Shields' bill.
I didn't
come in under the grab bag of
Senator Shields, because he knows how the bill was drawn. I'll accept an answer from anybody.
I apologize.
But the way this is described, Mr. Landauer, you seem to say that this bill would require, if you're posting a 24-hour notice for the citations just for homeless people for trespassing on public property. Is that what you mean?
Senator, you could repeat the question. I just want to be sure that I understand your question clearly.
Your statement says that this bill would require a 24-hour posted notice prior to issuing citation for somebody who was just trespassing on public property. Is that what you mean?
Or camping. That is the intent, as I understand it, of this particular bill.
We should be working from the dash one amendment.
I was just going from the previous one. And I'm trying to find out what the existing law does. It sounds as though that's not what it does.
if Senator Shields is correct in what he's saying about the bill.
I'm not sure that I'm following this totally myself.
Well, maybe I'll just shut up.
Senator, let me try to say that the existing ordinance for the 24-hour notice has been in existence for 4 years. Okay?
It doesn't change it.
Okay? And all we have added is that when you put up the 24-hour notice, you can't cite people at the same time. That's all I'm trying to do.
That's fine. All I'm saying is I don't think they understand that.
Well, they've had 4 years of dealing with it. I don't understand what's changed.
Mark, go ahead.
Thank you. Mark Landauer for the record. Our concern with this whole larger issue about homelessness and camping and so forth, and specifically with regard to 1071. We rarely issue citations to individuals in the city of Portland if they are camping. But it is used as a tool in a broader sense to help or at least compel individuals. There are carrots and there are sticks out there to help people help themselves. Some individuals loathe to seek that help. If we can compel an individual to seek that assistance that they may need, drug treatment, alcohol treatment, what have you, health care, what have you, by the threat of us issuing a citation, we'd like to have that option.
So what you're saying is you say, if you go with us and for this treatment, okay, if not, I'm going to issue a citation.
In instances, absolutely, that kind of occurrence does happen.
But you can do that if they represent some kind of menace or if they're doing drugs for which you'd want to get them treatment or something like that, but just for being homeless. And that's the issue. I also have my staff here. Maybe they have a comment that might help clarify.
Stand by, Jerry.
There's three chairs there in case anybody else
has a little question. Yes, then, sir. And talking about the citation, that means that the fine them maybe $50, $100. Okay, so what's the reason we are citing them since they cannot pay? And if they don't pay, do we put them in the jail or what's the purpose of it?
Well, again, that's an excellent question. That, you know, homeless people generally are not of the means to be able to afford a citation, and certainly I think that you can make that argument. But once again, it's the carrot and stick approach, Senator. We would like to try to get these people into the assistance that we feel is necessary or helpful to them to not be in the situation that they're in. And I'm sorry, I forgot the latter part of your question, whether we can arrest them. We can arrest them if they're violating a law. But once again, we don't want to arrest people unless they are committing some type of an offense, like dealing drugs or using drugs in a public place. I mean, if they're clearly violating the law, we will take the necessary approach to dealing with that problem.
Okay, one more question. How many homeless people do you have in Portland metro area? Maybe it's a seasonal sometimes.
Senator, I cannot answer that question and wouldn't want to try to guess. I'm sure that there are other individuals that could probably answer that more accurately than I can.
Thank you. Okay. Yeah. Okay, I'm looking at the time, committee, everyone.
Mr. Chair, did I move the dash one amendment?
No. Did you move?
Yeah, we didn't act.
Okay.
I moved them.
We never act. The Senator has moved the dash one amendment. It's on 1071. To deal with this point. Is there any discussion on 1071 amendment.
That's what. Sure. My only discussion is that as I look at the amendments, it does talk about issuing a citation to a homeless individual for trespassing. I wonder when the Senator Kerry said on the floor, if he will clarify what that means, that he means that in connection with camping or attempting to camp, and he doesn't mean somebody who's wandering around in a public building.
Right.
Trespassing.
Okay.
Okay. Because that's kind of open-ended.
Okay.
Okay. Any other discussion on Dash 1? Hearing none. Dash 1 amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 1071 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Shields moves 1071 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
There's three chairs there, anybody else?
I have a little question.
Yes, Senator.
And talking about the citation, that means that the fine them maybe $50, $100. Okay, so what's the reason we are citing them since they cannot pay? And if they don't pay, do we put them in the jail, or what's the purpose of it?
Well, again, that's an excellent question. You know, homeless people generally are not of the means to be able to afford a citation, and certainly I think that you can make that argument. But once again, it's the carrot and stick approach, Senator. We would like to try to get these people into the assistance that we feel is necessary or helpful to them to not be in the situation that they're in. And I'm sorry, I forgot the latter part of your question, whether we can arrest them. We can arrest them if they're violating a law. But once again, we don't want to arrest people unless they are committing some type of an offense, like dealing drugs or using drugs in a public place. I mean, if they're clearly violating the law, we will take the necessary approach to dealing with that problem.
Okay, one more question.
How many homeless people we have in Portland metro area?
Senator, I cannot answer that question and wouldn't want to try to guess. I'm sure that there are other individuals that could probably answer that more accurately than I can.
Thank you.
Okay. Yeah. Okay, I'm looking at the time, committee and everyone.
Mr. Chair, did I move the -1 amendment?
No. Did you move?
Yeah, we didn't act.
That's
I
right.
moved them.
We never act. The senator has moved the -1 amendment.
It's
not 1071. Deal with those.
Good
point. Is there a, you moved the 10, is there any discussion on 1071 amendment? -1.
Mr. Chair, my only discussion is that if I look at the amendments, it does talk about issuing a citation to a homeless individual for trespassing. I wonder when the Senator Kerry said on the floor, if he will clarify what that means, that he means that in connection with camping or attempting to camp, and he doesn't mean somebody who's wandering around in a public building.
Right.
Trespassing.
Okay.
Because that's kind of open-ended.
Okay.
Any other discussion on -1? Hearing none, -1 amendments are adopted.
Mr. Chair, I would move Senate Bill 1071 as amended to the floor with a new pass recommendation.
Senator Shields moves 1071 as amended to the floor with a new pass recommendation. Discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Aye.
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 Aye. Senate Bill 1071 is amended, but we'll go to the floor with a new pass recommendation. Senator Shields, you'll be carried. Okay. I'm going to. I'm going to close the work session on 1071, and I'm going to quickly move to public hearing on Senate Bill 1219. We'll be doing Senate Bill 1219 and Senate Bill 486. Okay. Yeah. Anybody from them?
Barbara Hutchinson.
Okay. Barbara Hutchinson is here. Do we have any discussions? Any questions on we had a work session on the hearing, I mean. And we have the amendment. Do you want to explain the -1 amendment, please?
Actually, we should have a -2 amendment in there, which is more current than the -1 amendment to members of the committee. The -2 amendment is basically the amended version of the -1 amendment based on recommendations from a department, from the Support Enforcement Division and Ronald Schenkel. Ronald's here to help us out if you have any questions about this.
From whom did we get the -1 amendment?
The -1 amendment came from Ronald also and Senator Corcoran's office.
Okay, so they're okay with the -2?
Everybody's okay with that.
Sure, I'm with the -2 amendment. So
yeah. Okay. Oh, wait. Is there any other testimony on this? Barbara? Okay. I'm going to close the public hearing on 1219. Open the discussion on Senate Bill 1219.
Move the -2 amendment.
Senator Trill moves the -2 amendment. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator.
Could you explain to me what the -2 amendment is?
Yes,
the
-2
amendment. A couple of points.
Yes, what's your question?
I heard it last.
Yes, last minute.
For the record, yes. Ronald Schenkel, Department of Justice, Support Enforcement Division. The primary difference between the -1 amendment and the -2 amendments are that in reviewing the -1s, which were in essence a get-in-step of the bill, to refocus, the same topic, but refocus the way we approach the concern. The addition in dash 2 is that we added a couple of provisions to say that when we're dealing with the possibility of suspending a license from an entity such as a partnership or a corporation, that the obligor that we give notice to is responsible to give notice to his partners or other shareholders that the license is in danger. We place that responsibility on that person rather than on the issuing agency or the child support program.
Okay. Any other questions? Okay. Any other objections? Okay, dash 1 amendment. The two amendments are adopted then.
Sure. Who's the rule? Is
number 14?
Corporate. Sure. Is there any opposition to the bill out there?
Anyone signed up?
Okay. Sure, I move the bill as amended before for the passage.
Senator Trell moves Senate Bill 1219 is amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Lynn.
Aye. By the way, so much
should
be. I think the court knew where.
Senator
Johnson. Aye. Not quite. Is it? Okay. Senate Bill 1219 will move to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Anybody want to chair it?
Senator Corcoran.
Well, Senator Corcoran will chair it. He will, won't he? Okay. All right, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 1219 and now open the public hearing on Senate Bill 486. Oh, there you are. Senator, you moved. I didn't see you on that side of the road. Good afternoon, Senator. Nice to have you with us.
Well, it came before you some time ago. It was very late and didn't get much of a hearing. I figured I'd convey your lies out here. I just would like to be upfront with you. We're going to oppose the bill. It's drafted. It would oppose any amendments to it. And I regret that because what it would do is simply, it's a very simple little bill. I like to think of it as pro-parent, pro-child, pro-family, but also pro-education, and I know there are education associations of America and they support it. So what it does, it says that a parent can have up to 35 hours a year, no more than that, but up to 35 hours a year, if they can take a leave without pay, or emphasize that, leave without pay, to go to the school where their children are, to be involved in school activities during the school days. You know, obviously parents can go after school, because often, most of the time, for most parents, their working hours are such that they can attend those things. And we say school activities, I believe the wording is, it can include anything. And it could help a teacher in a reading program. It could help, it could be there when there's speeches, there's plays, there's a variety of things. But as I recall, the language is school activities. And this is an amendment I want to make. The parent must make the request at least 7 days ahead of time in writing to the employer, and to allow the employer an opportunity to make any adjustments. It only applies to businesses 25 employees or more, which by the way, that parallels your present leave laws. We parallel the present leave laws as much as possible, so it reflects that. It isn't my intention to be anti-business or to burden businesses. I must tell you that there was another bill that I had introduced, to request United Way. It only applied to public employees, but they could be given leave, I think, to do voluntary service because the state of Indiana adopted a law. The state of Indiana actually adopted that law. Many public agencies wouldn't dare give their employees this kind of leave on a voluntary basis because government is so much under scrutiny. The private sector doesn't like mandates. You're going to hear that. I want to be fair to you. AOI, they just curse. They say it's the core issue. We're opposed to leave, family leave, or any kind of leave. Any existing leave stays intact. For example, if you had a very sick child, you wouldn't have to give, help me, 7 days notice. You could immediately go, and that applies. So we're not disturbing any of the existing leave laws at all. All we're saying is, would you consider this leave without pay for activities. I understand the state of Vermont does have this law. We live in a time, I don't want to get over emotional, we live in a time where we've done a tremendous number of polls, state senators, and the one lead area among all the polls they've done outside of parents wanting or people wanting more money or economic things at school, the one non-economic thing that stands out they wish them had more of was parental involvement in our schools. And my wife, when she taught 10 hard years in junior high school, it finally burned her out here at Whitaker. She taught and coached, but she finally burned out for two reasons. One of them was there was a time when their principal's administration wasn't that supportive. And the most important reason, though, was the lack of parental involvement. And I don't say that's true of all schools, but believe me, OEA supports the bill. And so it isn't like it's going to burden these teachers. They like to do this. And anything you can do to encourage the parents to be in these schools during the daytime without burdening the public sector, the nonprofit sector, or the private sector, I think you should do it. But I just regret that AOI is going to oppose it, but they are. It's going to be a front with you because they don't think they testified on the bill initially. I wanted you all to know that. I don't think it's allotted 35 hours, unpaid leave. You got to give them 7 days notice.
Isn't that 14?
I can make it 14. I've got amendments to say 14 right there, dash.
Correct.
That would be more than I prepared, dash 14 amendments to say, dash, what's that?
Dash 1.
Dash 1 would say you got to give 14. I've got that. I'll let that go. I've also got the dash, because right now it says, may be required by the employee may be required to give 14. I want that taken out. I do think the word must give written notice. That's the dash 2 amendment. So the dash 2, employee must give written notice. Can't just go in and say, oh, by the way, it's got to be in writing so that the employer has an opportunity to adjust. And I've got an amendment to move to 7. He came up with 7. I thought, well, you know, okay, businesses have got to adjust. So those are the dash 1 amendments. So I prepared those 2 amendments for you right there before you. And I don't know what else to say to you than that. It's a simple little bill. I don't want to get into a war with the business community. I haven't tried to sneak up on anybody on this thing. I think it's a great message to send to our communities, to our parents, and to our schools. And it's not a bad little idea. Not because I came up with it. It came out of some other state. So seriously, so that's it. And that's the best I can do.
Any questions for...
Pages 3 for employee, means a private employer or a public employer or all the employers. What are you talking about?
It means private, non-profit, such as YMCA, and it means public, such as public agencies. It means all. Providing there are 25 or more employees, which is the present family leave law, you have to have, it doesn't apply to businesses of less than 25 employees, Chair Duncan, Senator Lim. It does not apply. Your present leave laws do not apply to any business or any state agency or any employer that has less than 25 employees, Senator Lim. But it does apply across the board.
Okay, one more question. Yes, Senator Lim.
It's a 14 days in advance notice. You know, to take advance in maybe 1 or 2-3 hours, who can predict 14 days ahead whether they need the day or not? It is look like an impractical to actual application. You know, usually something will happen a day or the 1 week before. You know, 14 days, no one knows what's going to happen.
Well, that could be. That's why it's a good discussion. I thought 7 days, and it was a reasonable period of time to, because you know pretty much 7 days ahead of time if there's going to be a community event or something like that. So that's why we thought that. But I did prepare the 14 days if some people would be more comfortable. I do think you've raised a very good point, Senator Lim, that maybe 14, so if there's a lot of, you know, a teacher, dynamic teacher may not be able to always give that much advance notice as to think they're going to have in their class. So I had a week. but there's amendments there, 14, if someone would be more comfortable. So I'm not demanding you do 14. I really do want you to do, though, the -2 amendments, which require that the request be in writing by an employee. I do think that's a very good.
And again, you're emphasizing it's without pay.
It's without pay. It's with, that's an absolute given. I'm not playing games. They're not paid. They're on unpaid leave.
Right. Other questions for Senator?
I think don't you call for 35 hours, Peter?
35 hours.
You're not more than five in a 30-day period.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Mm-hmm. No, thank you. Up to 35 hours, but they can't take more than five within
one calendar month.
Within one calendar month. So there's also that limit on it. Okay. They can't take it all in one month. There's also that limit. Thank you. What I'm trying to do is to make it as convenient as possible for businesses, to tell you the truth, government agents and nonprofits. So they can't take more than five during one calendar month. If they see what I mean, so I hope I say it.
What was the rationale for choosing 35?
No, the 35, this bill was actually a redraft of a bill that was prepared last session. At that time, I remember there were discussions with proponents about how many days it should be. 35 days is what they eventually arrived at. 35 hours. Yeah, I think the idea was... I think that they just came up with a number, and I really don't know how they...
Other questions? We have several people to testify, and I
was just wondering, is that negotiable with this group too?
That's fine. Sure. That's fine. Magic, you're up absolute about 35. No.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Gotta be amenable. Gotta be.
You wanna stay around and join? I'll have some people showing you.
That's fine. Sure. I can leave. You better say I can leave. Yep. Maybe better.
No. It's very nice to have you here. Betsy, you're
very loving.
I'm AOI. You're the next to testify.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Betsy Earls representing Associated Oregon Industries. AOI, as you probably heard by now this session, is Oregon's largest business organization, representing over 19,000 businesses. Our members employ over 30% of Oregon's entire private workforce. AOI has long supported the essential notion that family leave must be available to employees for parental leave purposes, to care for a sick child or family member, or to take time off when the employee has a health condition that would make it difficult to work. Such policies, in our opinion, help strengthen families and ensure healthy, happy employees. It is important for employees' peace of mind to know that they will never have to decide between their job and their family's welfare. Senate Bill 486, which would require employers to allow an additional 35 hours of family leave per year, is an intuitively appealing idea. However, for practical purposes, implementation would be extremely difficult for employers. Employers may already be required to allow as much as 24 weeks for family leave under current law. 24 weeks is a long time, and adding almost another week is excessive. Senate Bill 486 will create serious scheduling and bookkeeping difficulties. For the short period of time that a worker would be gone for a school activity, employers will be unlikely to hire somebody else to do that person's job. That means that other employees will have to take up the workload of the employee on leave as well as their own work. Additionally, Senate Bill 486 creates bookkeeping hassles. Employers must keep track of the time workers take for family leave, and this bill, which allows for leave in small increments of time, will make that exercise more burdensome. Finally, Senate Bill 486 allows employees to use accrued sick leave time to participate in school activities. Employers provide paid sick leave for one reason, to cover employees who are sick. Requiring employers to allow paid sick leave to be used for this leave is basically requiring that they pay employees to go to their children's school activities. Such a requirement will tend to cause employers not to offer paid sick leave as a benefit. School activities are an important part of any child's development. However, time off to attend them is something that should not be mandated. It should be left to individual employers and employees to work out on their own in a way that best suits each situation.
I should state for the record, Mr. Chair, that this is a core issue of AOI and something that was very important to us. We very much appreciate Senator Courtney's attempt to make the bill a little more palatable to employers, but unfortunately that doesn't change the philosophical basis for our opposition, which is that this is the kind of situation that should not be regulated by government, that should be left to employers and employees to work out company by company on an individual basis. Thank you.
We do need to clarify something. I don't think that trying to
I have a very strong feeling about that. You know, I don't believe sick leave, even though it may be unpaid, I don't want sick leave used for this at all or be available for this at all. Counsel, do you want to speak to that, please, if I may ask? I mean, that's
Section 5.
That is not, that
is me, too.
I want to make it very clear that
members of the committee, that, again, that was the way the bill was introduced last session. It has been in there ever since. But if you wish to not allow use of sick leave, accrued sick leave, for purposes of this type of leave, it's simply a matter of deleting Section 5 from the bill, and that would do it.
I'm sorry, Mr. Chair. That was never my intention for this special emphasis. I believe sick leave is used because you're sick. And these people are not sick. You understand what I'm saying?
I understand. No, I'm in agreement with you.
I'm totally yours.
Yeah.
Aren't there places where people have negotiated this leave stuff and they've got some personal leave that's negotiated?
One might be able to have users. They want to take a vacation. I mean, I suppose you can't tell someone they can't use vacation time if they want to use that. But that means they've got to use up vacation time. Sick leave is a very specific kind of leave in terms of it's designed a certain way, and I have spirit and intent as the lawyer in me. It should only be available for you when you're sick, and that's how I feel about that. So I don't allow a response to Chair Duncan, Senator Tripp. Vacation leave can be used for a whole variety of things. You may not use it, but that's a different thing.
Here, let's put this bill up in the wayfinder equipment and watch it and see what we got.
Yes, there's a little bit of jeopardy in this whole thing at the moment. I was hoping, to be very truthful, I was hoping to send it out with either necessarily the Dash 2 and possibly the Dash 1. I wasn't sure about that one. Today, this will mean we need to come back, and I'm going to have to ask for an extension, which does put it all in jeopardy just a bit. But I'm going to use all my chips.
Why can't we send it forward with Section 5 in it, and then they can take it out on the House side?
Well, you'll lose it for sure.
Floor. They make you all angry.
It'll be very difficult.
They lost the floor anyway, but you know, you do that.
Just last night, hang on a minute, gang. Just last night, in this Streams Enhancement Committee, they did a conceptual amendment. And this is simple. This is not complicated. A conceptual amendment that just deletes Section 5.
We've done it two times for the Judiciary Committee in the last several days because I'm not telling the other money committee.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, we have done.
What's the matter?
We have our own rule. I'll read it to you. The committee shall not report a measure recommending that it do pass with amendments unless the LC drafted amendments have been approved by a majority of the members of the committee. A correction of clerical errors on amendments need not be approved by a majority member, but may be signed for by the committee chair. The corrected amendments must bear the written caption corrected.
All I'm asking,
we could suspend.
All I'm asking is, how could we do it last night in committee and not be able to do it today? I mean, it was a conceptual amendment, and they approved it.
We can suspend these rules if you want.
All right, got a good motion, Mr. Chair. All right, Mr. Secretary, you can always make it. Mr. Secretary recommends that we suspend rules by which we consider conceptual amendments.
Work session.
Oh, we're not in work session. You might go to work session. Oh, wait.
I need to go back. Lori has to. We're still in public hearing. Lori, aren't you going forward? Maybe you want to stick around because we'll.
Good evening.
I only refer to Betsy and moving away from you. Other people have questions for Betsy. I didn't want to. I did, so stand by. Once you come back up, and I'll call you in a minute. Lori, go ahead.
Mr. Chair, thank you. Lori Wimmer, Oregon Education Association. This has been a priority for the Oregon Education Association for 4 years. We have it in our legislative objectives to ultimately see this become a law of the state, and the reasons for it are several. I apologize that the sick leave piece is still in there. That was something that we tried for in the 97 session, but we are perfectly amenable to removing it, certainly. The idea is to enable schools to benefit from parent participation, but most especially for children to benefit from parent participation. Over a body of research over the last 30 years, one executive summary which I've attached to my written testimony, it is abundantly clear that the number one predictor of student success in schools is the ability of parents to participate. Now, I mean, when the principal calls you and says your kid's in the office because he hit a kid on the playground and he's going to take a one-day suspension so he knows never to do it again, as well as a field trip, as well as negotiating a child's individualized education plan for special education programs, and on and on. There are so many more things than seeing your four-year-old in a bunny suit doing her first concert. There are a lot of very important things. In the old days when it was much more typical to have a stay-at-home parent in the household, these kinds of laws weren't necessary, but we've got a very different demographic out there, and it's increased every year for the last 40 years, and there is no sign of abatement that all the children's parents or significant adult members, guardians, what have you, are in the paid labor force, at least part-time, generally full-time. And that means that there are fewer and fewer people to be in the schools to help out. We have swelling class sizes. You've all heard it all. You know it as well as I do. The need for parents to participate, be chaperones on the field trip, all of those things has never been greater. And the children's need for that evidence of support for the education programs has never been greater. We want to see a remedy. We figured that expanding the list of reasons for which one could take the family leave would be the most logical way to do it with the least impact to employers. We do believe in making sure that we strike a balance in that regard. I'd even go so far as to say that we don't need to add another day at all to the leave bank, as long as it would be enabled, a parent would be enabled to use their existing family leave bank for this reason. That's all we're looking for, so that they have job-protected unpaid leave to do that. Now, I will argue that the use of vacation leave is certainly their right, to the extent that the current leave law already specifies that it's at the employer's option which leave you use, which kind of personal leave, vacation leave, and so forth. That's already in law, and we are perfectly comfortable with that as well. I've also included with my testimony, it says just released today because I was originally planning to deliver this testimony March 4th, but so you'll forgive me if that's out of date, but I included a piece of the quality education model, the legislative preliminary report that talks about the parental participation model and the fact that the goal, one of the big goals of everyone who knows anything about how to improve schools and student performance is to get more parental involvement. We believe that this, by getting rid of one of the key obstacles to participation, we put our money where our mouth is in a manner of speaking. We make it possible for parents to do more. And for that reason, we've asked that you do this, and we thank you very much for taking all this time.
Questions for Larry? Okay.
There's been a lot of problem with this issue in the past.
Mr. Chair and Senator Lynn, we've all struggled with it over the years. It began in the mid-80s when we first passed pregnancy disability leave, and then we passed the parental leave, that's like maternity leave that fathers can take it to. And then we had family medical leave, and then the federal law came in, and we tried to conform all those leaves into one leave. And so in 95, worked in a very bipartisan fashion with the business community when Senator Gordon Smith was Senate President to develop a consensus law. And I served as the kind of different demographic out there, and it's increased every year for the last 40 years, and there is no sign of abatement that all the children's parents or significant adult members, guardians, what have you, are in the paid labor force, at least part-time, generally full-time. And that means that there are fewer and fewer people to be in the schools to help out. We have swelling class sizes. You've all heard it all. You know it as well as I do. The need for parents to participate, be chaperones on the field trip, all of those things has never been greater. And the children's need for that evidence of support for the education programs has never been greater. We want to see a remedy. We figured that expanding the list of reasons for which one could take the family leave would be the most logical way to do it with the least impact to employers. We do believe in making sure that we strike a balance in that regard. I'd even go so far as to say that we don't need to add another day at all to the leave bank, as long as it would be enabled, a parent would be enabled to use their existing family leave bank for this reason. That's all we're looking for, so that they have job-protected unpaid leave to do that. Now, I will argue that the use of vacation leave is certainly their right, to the extent that current leave law already specifies that it's at the employer's option which leave you use, which kind of personal leave, vacation leave, and so forth. That's already in law, and we are perfectly comfortable with that as well. I've also included with my testimony, it says just released today because I was originally planning to deliver this testimony March 4th, but so you'll forgive me if that's out of date, but I included a piece of the quality education model, the legislative preliminary report that talks about the parental participation model and the fact that the goal, one of the big goals of everyone who knows anything about how to improve schools and student performance is to get more parental involvement. We believe that this, by getting rid of one of the key obstacles to participation, we put our money where our mouth is in a manner of speaking. We make it possible for parents to do more. And for that reason, we've asked that you do this, and we thank you very much for taking all this time.
Questions for Lori?
Okay, so there has been a lot of problem with this issue in the past.
Mr. Chair and Senator Lim, we've all struggled with it over the years. It began in the mid-80s when we first passed pregnancy discrimination, pregnancy disability leave, excuse me, and then we passed the parental leave, that's like maternity leave that fathers can take it to. And then we had family medical leave, and then the federal law came in, and we tried to conform all those leaves into one leave. And so in 95, worked in a very bipartisan fashion with the business community when Senator Gordon Smith was Senate President to develop a consensus law. And I served as the kind of chair of the pro-family coalition that worked to rewrite Oregon's law so that it would be less complicated and more both worker-friendly and family-friendly, but also business-friendly. And I think that we achieved that, and it's been widely touted as a very popular, though rarely used, leave right for families.
Thank you, Lori. Let's see. I feel we sort of abruptly cut you off, and I didn't mean to do that. We had just sort of a big question all of a sudden.
I was done, so.
Well, did you just finish your testimony?
I did. I finished your repeat. Thank you.
Were there questions for Betsy?
I just want to say, one, if this were somehow or other, we negotiated the number of hours, would that make any difference to you?
Mr. Chair, we appreciate, Senator Trow, we appreciate the effort to make this more business friendly, but no, it wouldn't make the bill more palatable to us because it goes against one of our core beliefs as a business community, which is that this is what something that should be negotiated by individual employers and employees and should not be mandated or regulated by government.
Okay. Members of your organization, if a person went to a typical member of your organization and asked this time off about paid time, would they get it?
Well, it would be hard to say about a typical member because there's a broad spectrum.
No, I asked for a good employer.
Okay. Yes. Absolutely.
Well,
I've talked to Mr. Chair, I've talked to several members about this in the past.
I won't go into who they are, but the one that I'm thinking of right now said that typically, as long as they're given adequate notice, there's not a problem adjusting.
So good employers already do that?
Typically, yes.
Okay.
Unless there's some kind of particular work schedule problem that they're not able to accommodate.
And we assume it's possible within your organization you have someone who isn't really a good employer.
Mm-hmm. I don't know who that would be.
And, right, I won't ask you to name them. If you happen to work for one of those individuals,
mm-hmm.
rather than working for the other individual, does that create a bit of a problem when you have children in school?
Mr. Chair, I think that it probably does, but I believe that when you're balancing out the two issues, businesses need to be able to make these decisions on their own. That's who we represent, and that's we would always represent the business's right to make those decisions on their own and to have employees there when the employee, you know, has obviously taken the job, agreed to work for the employer, and has been scheduled to work. We think that's appropriate and reasonable.
Okay. The reason I asked the question of one of my very good colleagues, who is very business-oriented, was probably an outstanding employer himself, said any good employer will do this. I guess my concern is for the poor person who works for somebody who isn't, and that's where I'm coming. Because I'm looking at this day and age. There was a time when a member of the family could get away, and I'm not suggesting we go back to that. Yeah, that's not my point. A parent could go to school and be a participant, be a part of it. In our society and our economy today, I think in my generation, my wife, we work to pull things out. I look at my own kids today and their generation, I don't think that's possible with the way the work goes and so forth. And so I guess maybe that's why I have a tendency to be a bit more understanding of the, for the sake of the kids. Now, AOI is, you're supporting some things, education a high priority with AOI?
But you can't ask me to address that because that's about all I know about it.
Right. I admit
you're
just...
I'll tell you more than I do.
You have a... I understand where you're coming from. I just think I wish that the AOIs have been forward with some other things, and I'd say, gosh, you know, if you really were really interested in education, really want to move forward, these are some things the group ought to be looking for.
Mr. Chair, that argument has been brought up to us before, and I have to say that there are an awful lot of things that we could do for education before we did this that would make a much bigger difference.
Okay, I'm not convinced that the school-home-parent relationship isn't probably one of the biggest priorities we could have.
We agree that it's important, but we also feel that the employer-employee relationship in which the employer can expect the employee to show up for work when they're required to be there is important.
I would buy that, too.
Thank
okay.
you.
Any other questions?
My comment is, it's a good employer, bad employer is not that important. It's most important is that an employer can afford to let a person go sometimes at a crucial moment. That is the issue. I'm sure all employer like to work out with the employee, but the person like the cheap person doing the things, then they must go, then that is, I think that's the secondary issue.
Mm-hmm. And I'm sure that's an important issue to that. Okay, any other questions for Richard? Okay, anyone else wish to testify on this bill? To close the public hearing on Senator Bill 486, I'm going to open a work session on Senate Bill 486. And
which amendment do we need to
session?
Oh, okay.
Oh, that's correct.
First, we need to do the amendments.
Okay. Which amendment do you want?
I'm in a work session.
We're in a work session.
Right. Did you suspend the rule?
Not yet.
Okay.
We're just a work session dealing with the amendment.
Mr. Chair, I think that the move that the dash two amendment be adopted.
You want to, Senator Lynn, move the dash two amendments. Any discussion? The two amendments are...
Okay,
they must give notice. Okay. Discussion? The dash two amendments are adopted.
sheriff's bill ready?
No.
We've got to suspend the rules.
Okay, no one wants to do the dash one. That's fine.
It would stay at 7 days.
Seven days.
Okay. All right, Senator Cho. I'll move that we suspend the rules so that we can take action on this bill.
Senator Cho moves that we suspend the rules so that we can take action on this bill today with appropriate amendments. Is there any discussion?
Could you explain to me how that would work?
Well, if we just suspend the rules, then we can go ahead and
we don't have to have a 24-hour notice.
Right.
That's what you're talking about?
No, we don't. And we would just need Section 5.
Because
we have
24-hour
notice.
Yeah.
No, this
Chair Duncan, members of the committee, we're suspending our committee rules, which currently, at this moment, say that we cannot pass out conceptual amendments. So what we're doing, we're suspending our committee rules, so then we can have someone come up, explain our conceptual amendment, pass it out, and then move on.
Okay. Any other discussion? Clerk will call the roll.
Senator Lynn.
Aye.
Senator McHale.
Aye.
Aye.
Sure. The rules are suspended. We will have under consideration whether you're going to say, Chair,
I would move, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it's Section 5 that should be eliminated from the bill.
At least, okay.
Mr. Chair, I move conceptual amendment to Section 5 be eliminated.
Okay, Section 5. And do you want to explain that, Marcia?
Oh, will that work okay?
Yes.
Sir Duncan, Senator Trump, that will, and I just want to make sure you understand what that means. As the bill was drafted, we amended in Section 5 of the statute to make it clear that what it said was that you could use paid sick leave if you had it available. So that's going to eliminate that. However, by eliminating from the bill, the rule that currently applies with respect to vacation leave will still apply to this, and so you will be able to use any vacation leave you have available for the purposes of this type of
thing. Which has already existed anyhow.
That's the rule for all forms of family leave now under the law.
So it doesn't change anything technically, it just removes it from this particular section.
Right. Okay. Any other discussion? Okay.
We moved the amendment.
Okay. The conceptual amendment is Section 5 will be removed from House Senate Bill 486 as amended.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Is that a discussion?
No.
No, I just asked.
Okay. No objection? Hearing no objection, Section 5 is deleted.
Okay. The chair moves the bill as amended for the city pass recommendation.
Senate Bill 486 as amended. That means with the dash two amendments and the conceptual amendment, Section 5, okay, Senator Crowe moves for adoption.
Please.
Discussion.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator.
So this is the page 2 for 35 hours.
That stays.
That the, could we change it to smaller number. That is to make that the AOI ladies.
They said that wouldn't make any difference.
Yeah, it wouldn't make any difference.
We asked that question.
Yeah. I think it didn't make some difference.
Well, we couldn't do it because it wouldn't make any difference. You're saying no, but we couldn't do it anyway because we'd have to have a more complicated conception.
Yeah, I would feel a bit uncomfortable with that.
They could do that on the House side.
Okay. Maybe Betsy can talk to them to reduce it over there.
I'm sure that's the
thing. During the discussion, I clerk will call the roll. We're voting now on Senate Bill 486 as amended with the dash 2 amendment and the conceptual amendment.
Aye.
Aye. Senator Trump. Aye. Chair Duncan. Aye. Thank you. Senate Bill 486, as amended, with the dash 2 amendments and with the conceptual amendments, are adopted. see. Anybody?
Carrier.
Carrier?
Senator Courtney.
Senator Courtney, will you be the carrier?
No.
Okay, Senator Courtney is the carrier. Fourth session on Senate Bill 486. I can close the work session on 486 and closing the adjourning meeting for today. Thank you very much.